At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
The football pod with Paddy and Andy.
We wanted to hit Kerry like they were never hit before. And he goes, when we hit them, then we go, oh, but they don't like this. And then they went at them again. That's what Tyrone have to do.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
OTB AM.
With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
7:30 on this Friday morning. This is OTBAM. Owen and Tommy with you right the way through until 10 o'clock this morning. And we've got a packed couple of hours coming your way between now and then. We're going to be checking in on the Paralympics. We'll be looking ahead to tomorrow's All-Ireland football semi-final. We will be getting the Manchester City perspective on what is happening with Cristiano Ronaldo and a little bit of an insight to their perspective on the Harry Kane deal and the Harry Kane saga, really, that lasted over the past couple of months. And Alan Quinlan will be back with us after 9 o'clock, fresh from his holidays, for a few summer reflections. We would love to hear from you. As always, you can tweet us at Off the Ball, or you can drop a comment on the YouTube stream if that is where you're getting us this morning. Tommy Rooney, good morning.
Owen Sheehan, good morning. How are you doing?
I'm good. I want to say a big thank you to filling in for the OTBAM co-host yesterday. I enjoyed your contributions, and you really stepped in when some of the squad members got injured. That is what a team player is all about.
Not about her own. Yeah, that's what I'm all about. You know, stepping up when there's an issue or there's an emergency, or, you know, there's a cause to do so. So I was absolutely happy to. And Shane Hannan did a stellar job as well, you'd have to say.
Yeah, they did. Absolutely brilliant. I just want to say for clarity that cycling is the most dangerous sport ever in the world. And I now realise that. And kids, keep your eyes on the road or you're going to spend the night in hospital. And I think we should go on.
You look all right.
Yeah.
Like you've no scratches on the face. Listen, like you were wearing your helmet, obviously.
Listen, fresh as a daisy here this morning, Tommy. I mean, who cares about spending some time in hospital? It's all about brushing these injuries off and stepping up to the plate the next morning when the team comes and asks you for their service. So that's all we got to say on the matter this morning.
That's all we're saying. We're not saying there was no other bicycles involved, there was no other vehicles involved.
Well, it was genuinely, I would love if there was like somebody who is cycling around where I was cycling on Wednesday night with a GoPro, because I was involved in a one-man traffic accident with no other traffic and just myself. It probably will be largely hilarious. I was cycling along the Coast Road out in North Dublin, where there is a stone wall to your left-hand side, which I always kind of hug because the other side is the sea. But I don't know, there was a lovely sunset, Tommy. I was looking out over my shoulder, and when I was looking back, I was like, geez, that was a beautiful evening now. The heat wave is back. We've got this Indian summer. Kids are going back to school, but look at that 25 degree heat, and look at that beautiful sunset. There was almost a little tear in my eye. And after that little bit of an internal monologue, I looked back around and I was like, oh, I'm about to hit this stone wall full force. Now, exactly, I'm not exactly Sam Bennett here, but I'm going at a pace that would certainly injure you if you fell off, and that's exactly what happened, straight into the wall and away to hospital with me. So keep your eyes on the road, kids, is what I'm going to say.
It can very, very, very easily happen, Owen, and I'm just delighted that you were actually wearing your helmet, because I know I sound like I'm preaching here, but like, You're just probably lucky that you were, you know. And I know you had a long stint in A&E, but you know, no big wounds, no big problems. Everything's okay. The face is all right, and you can still present this morning. So well, I think you're good. You're okay.
We will see if I can remember who's playing who in the All Ireland semi final this weekend, and we can remember everybody's name. Then the consensus is that I am not concussed this morning. So this is an interesting social experiment to see if the helmet did indeed work on Wednesday night. Tommy, we should talk about Cristiano Ronaldo. We're going to be getting Sam Lee's take on this from Manchester City's perspective over the next little while. But one of the angles on this is one of your former boyhood heroes, you're a big Manchester United fan, is joining Manchester City to don the blue of Eastlands and say, I am a Manchester City man rather than a Manchester United man now at this point. Is this a big deal from your perspective, or is everybody who's not a Manchester United fan making this out to be a bigger deal than it potentially will be?
Well, I can't speak for every Manchester United fan. Like I was a Manchester United fan growing up as a boy, and they'd still be the team that I'd follow and I'd watch. Naturally, my adoration and love for them has sort of mellowed a wee bit over the last couple of years. But Ronaldo was a funny one. Like, 2003, I was 10 years old when Ronaldo was joining Manchester United. So if you're going to be influenced by a footballer when you're younger, or you're going to fall in love with a footballer, it was somebody like Ronaldo. But for me, when I was a kid, it was Wayne Rooney. Maybe that's to do with my surname. I don't know. But I used to love the fact that Wayne Rooney played for Manchester United. Absolutely.
How many Rooney jerseys did you have?
Oh, I had definitely three or four Rooney jerseys, 100%. But yeah, Rooney for me. But I'll be honest, though, there was always a feeling with Ronaldo that Ronaldo was going. He always felt like he was leaving Manchester United. And you kind of had to become accustomed to that when you were younger. And I know it's funny when you're a Manchester United fan, especially in that era, you nearly were spoiled, or you got used to the success and expectations of Premier League titles or Champions League trophies or whatever that was. And it was funny having to get used to the fact that Ronaldo was always going to leave. So in terms of footballers that I adored and was a fan of growing up, I'm going to get a bit of stick for this, or hopefully Kevin Kilbane doesn't jump in live on the air, but like, Roy Keane was the one for me growing up. Wayne Rooney was somebody that I loved as a footballer. Carlos Tevez was somebody that I absolutely adored. Right. I don't think I really allowed myself to get... Like, I was hurt when Tevez joined Man City. Like, I loved Tevez as a footballer. I don't think I'd be that hurt now if Ronaldo joins Man City, because it's just the state of where football is at. There's no hiding from it. Like, there is no romance in football anymore. Like, this week on the Football Pod, I threw it at Paddy and Andy. Who would you go and visit if you had the chance, a la Paul Walsh, when you were a kid? If you get a ticket somewhere, where would you go? Andy Moran picked Alessandro Del Piero. He wanted to go to Turin and meet Del Piero, or John Barnes. Paddy wanted to go see Maradona in Naples. Like, could you imagine if Messi went to somewhere like that, or Ronaldo went somewhere like that? And you know, the best player in the world actually went somewhere where it wasn't being handed to him by a state-based body, that all the money was being thrown at him like that, that it was a little bit of a challenger, that he was able to go and invigorate a club or a city, or just something a little different, rather than going to somewhere like PSG or Man City.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I just don't think that's going to happen anymore. I just don't think football, that's where football is at. Football has long been a game of money. And it's always been that way. It's no point kind of kidding ourselves, really. Like, so I won't be that hurt if Ronaldo goes to Man City. If Wayne Rooney had gone to Man City in 2010, 2011, that probably would have really, really, really hurt as a young football fan.
There's probably a statute of limitations on how hurt you can feel in these circumstances as well. Like you mentioned, Carlos Tevez.
Absolutely.
Carlos Tevez goes from Manchester United to Manchester City, so it's different. So I guess what has happened with Ronaldo over the last 10 years or so, and it's really interesting that you make that point, that even in the moment you felt that Ronaldo was always going somewhere. But I think that impression has definitely been hammered home, I suspect, given what Ronaldo did at Real Madrid, this sort of clicking in your brain to be like, ah, right, so there was another level for this guy to go to. So there was a reason why he wanted to go to Real Madrid, and there was another gear for Ronaldo to get to, and that's why he did it. So I think maybe his success at Real Madrid, does that actually diminish some of the hard feelings that Manchester United have for him leaving, and I guess diminish some of the hard feelings that they'll feel for him joining Man City at this point?
I don't know. I'm sure there's a serious amount of homegrown Manchester United fans that would be absolutely furious, and other Irish Manchester United fans that would be absolutely furious with Ronaldo joining Man City. I just can't get too worked up about it. I really can't. I'm just struggling to get upset about Ronaldo, because Ronaldo was always much more than Manchester United. And it's kind of funny saying that, because there isn't a huge amount of players that you would say that about a club of that size. But yeah, there was never any doubts about it. He was out the gap. He was going. And he won that Champions League in 08. He had that incredible season in 07-08, where he probably illustrated where he might get to when he scored 40-odd goals. And he was just absolutely sensational. But it was nowhere near what he actually did when he went to Madrid.
No.
You know, it was nowhere near it. Like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He's also joining a very different Manchester City to the Manchester City he would have played against, which is obvious given it's 13 years or so. But he leaves Manchester United just 1 year after the UAE takeover of Manchester City, whereas Tevez joins a year after their takeover and is part of the first great team with Manchester City. So it's an entirely different situation here, even if you're allowing for the passing of time, which will heal a lot of wounds in this scenario.
Yeah.
How much does this make you fear Manchester City in the present day, having Ronaldo?
Like, maybe it's the fact that I haven't fully processed it on, and it's early in the morning, and obviously this happened yesterday, and it kind of felt a bit surreal when you saw the news come true. I can't remember the Portuguese journalist who tweeted it, but
it does feel surreal.
It does feel a little surreal. Like, I know it's Ronaldo. We're saying most 36, 37 year olds, you'd say, they're getting on a bit. Like, Ronaldo will still do outrageous damage wherever he goes, wherever he ends up. He's still going to score a load of goals. Like, make no mistake about it, Ronaldo will absolutely improve Man City. But like, a wee bit like the Jack Grealish move. There isn't. They're not buying Ronaldo at their peak, at his peak. You know, it's not like if they bought Erling Haaland this summer, I think it's lights out, it's game over. Yeah. If they bought Kylian Mbappe, it's probably a very different conversation we're having here. But they're after dropping 100 million on Jack Grealish. They were looking at Harry Kane. They were kind of half going from half, like not really fully committing. Like with Ronaldo, like you're going to get a season or two out of him. I think it's probably going to sour relations if it can be soured anymore.
He'll do 2 years.
It's not a long-term signing. Like.
Yeah, he'll get 2 years. He'll do his two-year contract, which is what's on the table at the moment, and then maybe go back to Sporting. So he'll be 38 years of age at the end of his two-year... Like, Manchester City winning a Premier League title with a 38-year-old striker, if that's how it turns out, would actually be extraordinary. So extraordinary is too strong a word there, because it's Cristiano Ronaldo we're talking about. Yeah. But it would be unusual, and I think that is why you've got to look at this deal. And I completely agree with you. Haaland and Mbappe, it's lights out. And especially Haaland, given he is the exact sort of number nine that Manchester City are looking for at the moment. And Ronaldo's a bit different, and Mbappe is certainly a bit different. But I think Ronaldo and his age profile, it's not as a sure thing as Haaland or Kane joining Manchester City and changing the whole thing. There is definitely more of an intrigue and a fascination and a novelty about this move than a sort of fear, in my opinion. And I know I'll be eating humble pie when Ronaldo pops up with 35 goals and steals penalties off Kevin De Bruyne this season, and that's the way it goes.
He probably will. And like, it was Gonzalo Lopez that tweeted it yesterday. I got this whole thing in the overdrive that Ronaldo to Man City is a done deal. And like, is it a little surprising that Manchester United haven't thrown their hat in the ring here? Does that just signify that they've kind of changed the way that they're approaching transfer windows? Like, obviously, they added in Ibrahimovic, they brought in Falcao. You know, Zlatan sort of worked, Falcao didn't. They had a couple of, like, Di Maria didn't necessarily work.
Interesting
Isn't
point.
Is it a little surprising that United haven't jumped in here and thrown it? What money are we talking here? Like, it looks like it's going to take a big pay cut to go to City regardless. And Juve, I don't think there's a huge fee, like, so.
Yeah, it's 25 to 30 million euro, and he's earning 31 million a season after tax at the moment in Turin. He's going to take a bit of a pay cut, as you mentioned, on that. So, yeah, maybe, like, I think...
I'm happy they're not going for him, by the way. Like,
yeah.
I'd far rather see Mason Greenwood banging in goals this season.
Well, that's the exact thing. There's enough young talent there in that attack at the moment to give Manchester United hopes. But, as I say, we're going to be joined by Sam Lee a little bit later on to get his perspective on everything. It's not a done deal just yet. The Harry Kane to Manchester City thing looked like a done deal a month or two ago, and we all know how that finished up. So nothing can be certain at the moment, but it does seem that Jorge Mendes has been in conversation with executives in Turin over the course of the last 12-24 hours and has moved on to chatting to Manchester City. So that is a pretty good notifier that things have gone smoothly so far in this deal, and just ironing out what Cristiano Ronaldo wants from his contract, given he's going to be taking a pay cut, is probably the only remaining hurdle at the moment. And then, of course, there is the futures of the likes of Bernardo Silva and Raheem Sterling that come as byproducts of the story, because City will need to clear the deck. So there's a lot of interesting stuff to get into with Sam a little bit later on. We're going to be joined by Louise Galvin very shortly to chat Kerry Tyrone and the quick picks indeed. But Tommy, very quick question for you. I was out yesterday, obviously. The day before, it seemed that our Kerry Tyrone prediction had gone from 8 points to 7 points to 6 points. Had it dropped down to 4 or 5 point win for Kerry yesterday?
In my own mind, or are you talking in
on the show? It seems that we've been the driving the living organism that is the Kerry versus Tyrone line at the moment. The betting odds seem to have reflected all the conversations we've had. Jer has essentially pushed the spread back towards Tyrone a little bit over the last few days. Did that continue yesterday? Was the agenda still happening, is what I'm asking?
The agenda is certainly a real thing, Owen, and I always take great pride in the fact that in the build-up to any game, if it's being skewed in one way or another, if there's heavy favourites, it's always good to even it out, you know. And the case has been made all week for what Tyrone should do to beat this Kerry team, 100%. What can they do? Where can they get to? I'm not going to be back in Kerry by 10 points. It could very easily happen, but I won't be making that mistake. I hope to God that we're going to see Conor McKenna racing through very early on and burying a goal. Kerry have a very, very, very tough opening quarter or two. And I think that could be the best thing for Kerry, that this game goes down to the wire. Might be great for your heart, but I have a feeling this game is going to be close.
Well, they all have been. Like, I mean, Kerry have won the last couple of games, and there was definitely a few heart-stopping moments in the last two. Tyrone have got better. I suspect Kerry have got better as well, though. So we'll see. We'll get into that with quick picks a little bit later on. I think you're still on top of the table, Tommy. Go on.
We have a couple of comments coming in there on Paul McGee. Oh, Owen, too early to be laughing so much. Hilarious indeed. I think he's talking about your bike accident there. Shifty lad got in touch. Jesus, Owen. Bike accidents are no joke. Any tough
really
one
aren't.
Also. Good that you're okay. Shifty's spot on there.
I think it's when you have your first one. Once you have your first one, then you kind of wake up to what a... Because lack of cycling prowess has been a feature of this show for many a year now. And I was like,
you're getting there.
The great thing about being crap at cycling is that you can't hurt yourself. And then once you get onto a bike-only road, you're like, and the cars can't hurt me either. So you can admire a sunset and you can look around and enjoy the views until you cycle straight into a brick wall.
Into a wall. Hey, but look, at least you're wearing your helmet. That's all I say to you. 93 Rubik's Cube. United holding out for Haaland next summer. We'll wait and see. And then Cam 6511. Tommy looks like he was in Cooper's last night. Cam, I can confirm that I wasn't in Cooper's and I certainly wasn't in Copper's. There's just a bit of a bedhead on me.
Tommy, I'm
just the way I am.
I'm not going to lie. And I know I'm breaching confidences here, but in our production booth, when they were phoning you up, we can hear them chatting to you, testing your line beforehand. I'm not going to break any confidences here or name any names or anything. But the only quote I heard was, that guy looks like he's just rolled out of bed. Isn't it great that you can just wear what you want and look like you want when you're working from home?
So that's just the way it is.
Tommy, good to have you with us this morning. We're going to be back with you after 8 o'clock to chat through the quick pick. So that's coming your way a little bit later on. Also, the Paralympics will be bringing you up to speed and everything from 9 o'clock. One of the other stories overnight and from yesterday evening really was Shamrock Rovers crashing out in Europe. They lost 1-0 to Flora Tallinn on the night, and Flora advanced to the next round of the Europa Conference League after winning 5-2 on aggregate. So a disappointing enough evening for Shamrock Rovers in the end, and here is their manager, Stephen Bradley.
You made two changes, bringing in Aaron Green and Danny Mandroyo. So what was the plan of making those changes?
Oh, we just tweaked a little bit. We felt that Aaron and Danny's pace could cause them problems, and I felt it did in the first half. We got in a couple of times, but the keeper made some saves, I thought Danny and Aaron would cause them issues with their pace, and I felt they did.
And that was the thing, after 12 minutes I think it was, you started really kind of put the foot in the throttle. You got a couple of really good chances. I suppose Flora Tallinn probably came here thinking, if we can get through the first half 0-0, you know, our confidence will grow. And do you think maybe the fact that you didn't get a goal in the first half, that really kind of gave them the confidence to want to win the game?
No, I don't think, we didn't have to score early. We could have scored in the 80th minute and still being fine. Like, you know, we've scored so many late winners this year, we felt we'd be fine. But I felt the turning point in the game was the goal. We give away the goal and that really knocked us. And you could see then they completely grew from that, and that was the one that hurt us.
And you said to yourself last week there were sloppy goals, same again tonight. Yeah. You know, it was uncharacteristic. You've only conceded 18 goals in the league this season. Why do you think that sloppiness came in on the big stage?
I don't know. Sometimes it's nice to get a kick in the backside to give you a reminder that the basics needs to be right. Unfortunately, we got it last week and conceded 4 goals. Tonight, I thought we were very good. We limited them to one chance, I think, in the game. And on another night, Alan saves that quite comfortably. Look, over the two legs, we made some really bad mistakes, but to be fair to them, they were a better team over the two legs and deserve to go through.
I suppose domestically now, it's all about trying to, you know, go on and win that league title again. When you kind of look back on the European experience this season, what are your kind of general feelings of it?
It's been a fantastic experience. Every experience in Europe is good, whether you win, lose or draw, because you're learning, you're becoming better. We will be better for these games that we played this year, and the aim is to make sure we go and win the league and put ourselves in a really strong position again in Europe next year.
Stephen Bradley there speaking after Flora Tallinn won 1-0 at Shamrock Rovers last night. Stephen Doyle there in conversation with him afterwards. It is 7:49 on this Friday morning. OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Let's tell you what's coming up over the next couple of hours here on OTB AM. So Louise Galvin is standing by and we'll get to her in just a moment. We'll go through the sports pages. Ellen Keane dominating proceedings, as you can imagine, this morning across all the back pages and some of the front pages indeed this Friday morning. The GAA quick picks focusing on one game only, as Tommy and Adrian, I think, do battle at the top of our table at the moment. Sam Lee will be chatting through the Ronaldo to Manchester City news and how the Harry Kane deal fell through after 8:30. And then the Paralympics update with Phil is coming your way at 9:00. Alan Quinlan, as I mentioned, is back from his summer holidays and is going to be with us from 9:15 to talk through some of the learnings he's taken from watching the Rugby Championship and some residual Lions thoughts from 9:15. And then John Giles was on Thursday Night Football as ever last night, and we'll play that out from 9:30 this morning. So we are focusing on tomorrow afternoon's All-Ireland football semi-final. It is Kerry against Tyrone, 2 weeks later than advertised, and delighted to welcome Kerry footballer Louise Galvin to the show to preview. Louise, how are you getting on?
Good on, not too bad now.
So this Tyrone team, if we forget all the COVID issues for just a moment, are trending upwards, I think it's fair to say. New management, a young team, and are a really exciting team, if not for now, then at least for the future. Kerry have beaten them in 2015, have beaten them in 2019. So for the sake of this rivalry, from Kerry's perspective, how important is it that they keep winning in this rivalry and keep getting one over the opposition? Because we know from the 2000s just how important that momentum can be in a Kerry-Tyrone rivalry.
Yeah, I suppose it is massively important, but it is secondary to Kerry's ultimate goal, which is get to the All-Ireland final, and it's just Tyrone that they're facing. But there is a lot of, you know, I suppose any time two teams play that have a bit of a history, you're going back towards the noughties. But in truth, I mean, this is Brian Duer of one sideline, but we don't have an awful lot of, I suppose, players that were directly involved in that rivalry in the noughties. So I don't think it matters as much. And the style of football that Tyrone brought back then certainly was effective, and it worked for them, and it changed football for a number of years. But I think we've come away from that now, so it's probably not as relevant as people make out. It's just nice to maybe fill the column inches in the run-up to the game. I think what's more pertinent for Kerry is that they've had their most recent wins in a lot of tight semi-finals, and that it's gotten them into the final. So they'd be looking to keep that going with the semi-final as well, but purely on the basis because they want to win in All-Ireland. And I think just keeping that rivalry up and maybe that little bit of dominance in championship football over Tyrone is an added bonus, really.
Who's made the bigger strides forward from Kerry and Tyrone's perspective since 2019?
Oh, well, I guess we've had such a blip in 2020. We were just caught so cold against Cork that you can't say that, you know, reaching an All-Ireland final and going to a replay, a game we should have won day one, and then going out in a Munster semi-final was a really progression from 2019. But certainly this year, you can't be impressed by the way Kerry have gone around their business. Obviously, we didn't have a league final, but had a very good league. And then haven't had a huge amount of competition, would have been disappointed with what Cork showed up with in the Munster final. But we've done what we've needed to do, racked up an awful lot of scores. As always, there's always a little bit of question marks over Kerry's full back line, but I think that's more, rather than the man-to-man markers that we have there, I think that's a little bit of the style of play that not only Kerry but Gaelic football has gone, and that has gone into a bit of a shootout again. And when you have such an attacking half back line and you have midfielders that can get forward and score, and cornerbacks, like, look, we've Thomas Sullivan, Breno Big League chipping in to score as well. Like Morley came on and got a point in even that Munster final when he would have been coming up from the full back line. So when you have that kind of style of play, you'll always have those question marks about your full back line because you're not stacking the numbers back there. And inter-county football, you're always going to have those incredible inside forwards that if you leave them one-on-one, they're going to score. You're just hoping you're going to outshoot them at the other end. That's the way football's gone, and that's the way Kerry are playing as well.
It's a really interesting point, and it brings us nicely on to the comments from Gavin Devlin over the last couple of days. I'm sure you've seen these. He's done a piece. I'll credit now in just a moment. I seem to have just lost it here. He has said that there is a reason why Kerry come out and play in the middle of the field with 15 men behind a ball, because they don't trust the men at the back. Team Talk Mag, sorry, is who he was speaking to. The quotes are referred to in the Examiner this morning. So it looks like he's looking at things from a different perspective to you there, that it's about a lack of trust that Kerry have for their defenders, and that is why they play the way they do.
I do. I agree with him that if you get the Kerry full back line on one-on-one situations or a lot of space, and Cork did it in the at the beginning of the Munster final, and you run at them hard. And Sean Powder, I think, was on with yourselves earlier in the week, and he mentioned even the Munster's semi-final last year that that's how they targeted Kerry, was to run at them hard. That's no big secret. But I think, again, it's because Kerry have looked at the players that they have, they've looked at the style of play and said, right, we're still going to work hard. We're going to try and block teams up from number 15 back, but we're always going to try and outscore teams, and we're always going to give our half back line a license to attack, because they add a lot of pace to our attack, and they add a lot of, you know, players coming in, making a run, flushing out weak side, creating maybe a little pocket of space that then a David Clifford or a Paul Gainey can pop into. So I think it more is the style of play that we've gone and decide to play with. And yeah, obviously then when we concede the ball, whether it be up front, whether we leave a short kick out, we're obviously going to defend with 15 players. I mean, that's Gaelic football now. Your six forwards don't just switch off, or your inside line don't just switch off. I mean, look at the incredible tackling that Mayo did against Dublin. That was you know, so important to them turning Dublin over. I mean, we all have that clip of Davy Byrne soloing over the end line. I mean, that's incredible at that stage of the game. So, you know, I don't think it's necessarily we're doing that because we really don't trust our full back line. I think it's a bit of a product of the whole system that we're playing.
Absolutely. And the other thing, just to go through some of these here, is about what Kerry are going to do in terms of matchups and what Tyrone are going to do in matchups. Just to stick with some of these Gavin Devlin quotes. The headline, by the way, is Devlin wants Tyrone to expose Kerry for what they really are. So he's thinking putting Rory Brennan and Paddy Clifford. He hasn't played a lot of football this season, but he's a serious defender. Then we have Padraig Hampsey and Ronan McNamee, and you can take your pick with Paul Gainey and David Clifford. Either one for me. I'd put Petey Hart on Sean O'Shea and bring Conor Myler back on Stephen O'Brien. I think we win all those battles. I think we win them all. So David Clifford, Sean O'Shea and co are all going to get beaten by their men on the day tomorrow, is what Gavin Devlin reckons. Gavin Devlin, by the way, the former Tyrone coach who worked at Mickey Hart. What do you reckon, Louise? Is he right?
Again, I think if Sean O'Shea sees Peter Hart coming towards him, he's going to bring him into the full back line where he's not used to playing, and where you're taking away some of Peter Hart's strengths, where he wants to bomb forward a little bit as well. So that is one thing about this Kerry forward line, is because you have a Paul Gainey who's lining out maybe a half forward line, can drift into the full forward line. Likewise, Sean O'Shea played an awful lot of most of his football, inter-country football, up until this year in the half forward line. Now he's playing a lot more inside. So I think if Kerry, depending on their matchups, they'll look to expose the weakness. And, you know, Tyrone don't have players that necessarily are as comfortable in the full back line, half back line. So I think, depending on who picks them up, they might switch it around a little bit. And again, look, a lot can be made about matchups at the beginning of the game, and you'll always have one or two that you'll probably stick, like where this is, you know, McCann or whoever sticking to David Clifford. But you can't have six backs or five backs consistently sticking to one player, because the movement is too much. And I think, again, Sean Powder in his clip with yourselves earlier in the week alluded to this, like you have to be prepared to mark a few different players. Sometimes a lot can be made of matchups earlier in the game. I also don't think Tyrone are going to leave themselves, or they're going to aim to not leave themselves one-on-one in a lot of situations. I think they're actually going to, even though they're quite attacking earlier on in the Ulster Championship, I think as it's progressed, they've become a little bit more defend en masse and break out en masse. And I think that's going to be their goal against Kerry, is to try and block up the defence, not leave these guys one-on-one, because, you know, it's only going to be one outcome. And then use their pace and their fitness and their attacking use to try and get up that field as quickly as possible. Get ball in early to the likes of McCurry and Matty Donnelly, and try and expose them against potentially a Kerry full back line that might be a little bit isolated if we have Gavin White and a Paul Murphy or whoever who decide to bomb up the field.
So you're seeing basically 13 men behind the ball for Tyrone as their default from the start of the position, with the two up front. And as you rightly say, it'll definitely then be one-on-one in both of those positions, because Kerry will follow all 13 men, but they probably will stay, they'll obviously stay with the two left up front, which if Tyrone gets a turnovers will obviously be a lethal tactic for them. The question is, are Kerry susceptible to giving up the turnover when they're attacking?
Look, they're generally very good at ball in hand, but again, there's so much unknown because both teams are coming in. Like Kerry have played in 5 weeks, Tyrone obviously 4 weeks, and there's a lot that we don't know about how Tyrone are going to turn up, how they're going to play, who's been affected by this COVID outbreak. There's a lot more known about this game than we often have going into an All-Ireland semi-final. I think one positive for Kerry with that long break is Dermot O'Connor picked up that injury early in the Munster final. We're hoping he's okay. Peter Keane has reported a clean bill of health, and obviously Darren Moynihan, who's been doing very well, he's hopefully back in contention as well. So in the Munster final, they started Jack Barry at wing forward, and I know he probably would have been pressing for Dermot O'Connor's position, but now there's a lot more to play for Peter Keane. There's a lot more for him to select between. You know, Jack Barry did relatively well. Dermot O'Connor, how fit is he? Versus a Darren Moynihan and Micheál Byrne's coming in as well. So Kerry probably have all their aces back in the pack as well. I don't think we're going to get caught cold, because I think it happened last year, and I don't think it can happen again another year. I think what Kerry do have to do, though, they've got to back their legs, because even if Tyrone come out all guns blazing, they have to back that if whatever 17 of these players are affected, even if they're mildly affected, even the fact that they weren't able to train, Kerry have to push them from 55 minutes on to see, do they have the legs for championship pace, for championship intensity? And it's probably not something that's, again, playing with incredible intensity at the end of the game. Kerry like to control the game. They like to use their football. But I think we have to be prepared to absolutely push. And, you know, we don't have too many men the wrong side of 30. So I think we really have to back our legs. And if this is a tight game, which absolutely could be, you know, 1-2 points in it, coming up to 60 minutes, I think Kerry have to raise the intensity levels, and they have to take that knowledge. Much like if you're playing someone and they're just back after a big knee injury, you take them on. I think they have to trust that their legs are going to be stronger than Tyrone's, purely on the basis of, well, they've had COVID through the camp, and even if it's mildly affected them, it still would have affected, at the very least, their ability to train in the last few weeks, if it hasn't affected their actual cardiovascular fitness from a medicinal point of view.
Does your cardio dip a little bit without a game in 5 weeks? I know the in-house games with the panel Kerry have are extremely strong, no doubt about it. But without a competitive fixture, do you dip a little bit after 5 weeks off?
I don't. Your cardio won't dip because, again, your strength conditioning, you've planned for this. Although, obviously, they would have planned for 3 weeks initially, and then a little bit of, a juggling of balls in the middle. But it's more the sharpness, I think, and the more mental side of it. But again, because we've had that game last year, that getting beaten by Cork, I don't think that's going to be an issue. But no, that would be, I mean, with GPS, with heart rate monitoring and everything, and these guys are so finely tuned that, I mean, it's not like they need to put a whole lot of hard yards. The bank, it's more just about, okay, monitoring load, trying to peak and then just deload to a certain amount this week so that they're ready to go at the weekend. So it's more the fore planning. It's not going to be fitness. It's more about, I suppose, that element of sharpness. And again, when your player's back in the mix, trying to decide who is your best 15 to start game.
Kieran Whelan was down in Kerry last week. He was in Listowel. He said, when chatting to the locals, their main concern was reflecting on whether winning the All-Ireland and not beating Dublin in the process would be classified as a genuine All-Ireland success. Whoever he was talking to are not playing the Yarra game very well, Louise.
No, they're not. I said this to some non-Kerry people during the week. I said, those Kerry people disappointed Mayo won, not because Mayo won, but because there was that sense of, but we have to beat Dublin.
Yeah.
And look, that's there. Any Kerry person who tells you that they weren't thinking that are a true football fan, well,
they're a liar.
They're playing a bit of the Yarra game. Yeah. And you can be damn sure if we go on and win an All-Ireland, which would be absolutely fantastic, beat our own, beat Mayo, you can come back on here and say, lads, but you didn't beat Dublin. It will be thrown back in the face, and you have to beat Dublin now next year to be truly considered, you know, a good team or better than Dublin. So, but listen, that's outside of our control, and fair play to Mayo. We have to do what we need to do now and make sure we're not caught hop against what's like Tyrone love their backs the wall. They love all this kind of, oh, the GA wanted to throw us out of the championship. They'll be playing that up gung ho. Listen, this is not going to be any sort of sentence of a walkover. The league game in Clarny is completely irrelevant. This is going to be some battle tomorrow. They're going to be trying to get stuck in as much as possible. And even, you know, the likes of Gavin Devlin coming out with comments like that, you know, they're trying to, they're already trying to scratch underneath the surface. And then you have the likes of Peter Kahneman kind of saying, you know, we'd be looking to be a few points behind because obviously COVID and that. And you're like, lads, you've no intention of just being a few points behind. You're coming up here to win, building nicely. Again, when you look back at the Ulster Championship, obviously beating Donegal is a big scalp, but there's a lot that went against Donegal that day that, you know, if Neil McGee hadn't gone off, I mean, how...
Murphy.
Michael Murphy.
Yeah.
Yeah, missing a penalty. Black card, yellow card before half-time. Could have, you know, Donegal could have had another penalty claim not long after the missed penalty. So, I mean, fair enough, they went down, they won that game by 6 points. But it was a bit of hair and scare for them as well. And they've pushed on against Monaghan. And that's a dangerous team, a team that are winning closely and building with each game and starting to create a lot of belief within their own system. So who knows? But I think we have to, if we're going to go with form, what little form we have and the knowledge that, you know, Tyrone have had their training, I suppose, interrupted for whatever, you know, players out injured or out with COVID, then we have to hope that Kerry are going to, well, not hope, but I hope that Kerry are going to come out the right side at the end of the day tomorrow.
Yeah, and you say that Tyrone are using all these different factors as private motivation. I think it's pretty public at this stage that they've been using it, and I think it's not only just the way they've been written off, and in fairness to them, they are the one crowd who can say we have been written off because they have been written off by so many people. I think that's changed as the week has gone on, but I also think they've used that league results as some sort of motivation, that they've used that to put a layer on top of this about being written off. And Conor McKeown in the paper this morning makes a really good point that, like, you can actually look at games after that to see if the Kerry side of things that day in Killarney against Tyrone stood up. And you look at Kerry's Munster Championship, and it does stand up. Their most recent game, they were absolutely outstanding. So it's not like as if Kerry-Tyrone was the last game Kerry played. We do have one half of that rivalry going toe-to-toe tomorrow that have shown us form that is becoming of that day when they scored 6 goals that afternoon. So I wonder, are we playing down the chances or the relevance of that game a little bit too much?
I suppose from a Kerry point of view, when you want to play down because you don't want to go in thinking you're sure a 16-point better team. And from a Tyrone point of view, you want it to be irrelevant because you don't want to think it's a 16-point worse team, you know. So I think what's, you know, there could be an element of Kerry showing their hand in that game and Tyrone saying, well, they can't get any better than that, lads, but we've gotten a lot better. I think Kerry have been rattling in the goals this year in the league and championship. That'll be a huge, huge focus for Tyrone is to not let Kerry get goals because it's like oxygen to the team. So I think even if they're, you know, giving up and they're racking up the points, I think this Kerry team, they're kind of living off, not that they're living off goals, but you can see there's a change when they score. It's worth more than the 3 points on the scoreboard. I'm trying to make some sense of this. So I think Tyrone will have an absolute focus on not conceding goals, which might be an obvious statement, but more because of the scoreboard, more than the scoreboard, more what it kind of means to Kerry and that kind of boost that it gives them, because there's certainly previous Kerry teams were kind of happy to take their points and keep the scoreboard taken over, but there's something a bit more ruthless about, and it's not just the David Cliffords and the Shawnee Shays, it's you know, we've Gavin White, we've the bats coming forward going, yeah, I want to get on the end of a goal, like, so there's definitely been a shift in mindset that they're a bit more goal focused this year, and they're rattling them in, so I think that's going to be a huge focus for Tyrone.
For sure, absolutely. I get the sense from what you're saying that you're not confident that this is going to be a healthy win by any stretch of the imagination, but you're confident enough to predict Kerry.
Confident enough to predict Kerry, because I think, you know, similar to the 2019 semi-final, if we're struggling, we have a few game changers to come off the field, come off the bench. So again, the likes of a Tommy Walsh, who can change, he's a different type of player. He's great at winning ball and bringing other players into the team, into the game. Killian Spillane as well, anytime he's come on, he's, you know, kicking over 3 or 4 points from play. So I think along with our bench, if things aren't going to plan, we have some changes. I'm not sure if a Darragh Moynihan starts. Mm-hmm. Does that mean, you know, Steve or someone doesn't? And again, that's another all-star that you're bringing off the bench. So I do think we've enough to make changes both up front and defensively in the midfield as well. So
yeah,
I think we have it. Yeah, but it's not. I don't think it's going to be a big win, no.
Louise, just before we let you go, we haven't been chatting to you for a while. Obviously, you were back in the green and gold yourself this summer. What was it like being back, and how did you enjoy the league and championship?
Yeah, it was class being back, to be honest. Really, really enjoyed it. I suppose it's been about 6 years since I played inter-county football. And yeah, like, it was great to see the setup that we have down in Kerry. Daryl Armdeck and Quill, joint managers, were, you know, they've done a great job, and to see the depth of talent within the squad that have come up through underage. Had a difficult, I suppose, got the Division 2 final and maybe unfortunately beat Meath in an away league game that opened up the campaign, and thought we weren't great that day. But actually, when we played them in the league final again up in Coe Park to get promotion, they well turned us over, and they've just gone from strength to strength since then. And obviously they're playing in All-Ireland final next weekend against Dublin. Probably then had two tight losses against certainly Galway was a 1-point loss, and Donegal in our championship group that ended up meaning we had to play a relegation semi-final against Tip, which thankfully we won well. But like, certainly what I can see in ladies football since I've last played is like the pace of the game, the fitness has come up so much, and the skill level. And I just think we need to move with the game a little bit, in terms of certainly what biggest frustration for me this season was, you're not even asking me this, but I'm ready to give my spiel anyway. It's like the inconsistent application of the rules. Like, you'd certainly, because we're playing in Division 2, at times you've refs who want very little contact. Girls are, they're fit, they're strong, they're fast, they're prepared for contact. And at times, just, I think the rules, first of all, they can be inconsistently applied. So I think you can play another game and the refs can play it completely differently, and you're like, oh, this is great, we can actually play a bit of contact. That I just think it needs to be looked at, because, and I think it's, you know, a lot of the Camogie players are the same. We're doing all this gym work, we're doing all this conditioning, and yet the game is kind of not really caught up with the level that the players are at. So I think that's something that does need to be looked at. But overall, just hugely impressed with the standard nationwide. And, you know, Dublin, again, we didn't pay them this year, but they're the standard setters, they're the goal setters. But there's a lot of teams that are coming around a similar level behind them, and I'm hoping Kerry are going to be one of those in the next few years as well.
Because Mick Bone was saying the exact same thing recently about the application of the rules. Like, so you're saying that in Division 2, basically, that the rules are, not the rules being applied, but the referees are more whistle-happy in that division than they are at the top level?
Yeah, I found that. And I found when we then went to play in our championship group game, certainly in that game against Galway, we were bitching and moaning at the ref, because we were like, we were getting soft frees in Division 2. But actually, when I look back, that's the ref, the way he played it against Galway, against Donegal, was the way I'd like to play the game. It's the way we'd like to play the game. But we got used to, you know, refs telling us at the start of the game, no contact. And oh, the only way you can just dispossess the bear is if you can intercept her without touching her as she's hopping soloing. So, and that wasn't every game. Certainly the games against Meath were probably a bit more physical, because again, we were probably two bigger, we were probably the top teams in the division. But yeah, definitely when you came up to senior level, it was a bit more allowed. But again, there's times like in that Dublin-Donegal semi-final or quarter-final, where I think Mick Bowen made the comments afterwards. I agreed with him absolutely that day, like, there was such non-fouls given as fouls. And again, that's become really fast and free-flowing, has become whistle-happy then. And players, you know, you don't know what to. And the thing about ladies football is the yellow card is 10 minutes of the bin. It's more than, so if you pick up two or three tickings and you get a yellow card for, and a lot of the times barraging seems to have come in massively, where they feel that the attacking players, who's just trying to run hard and strong, is they're giving away. And even if they're trying to turn out of the contact, but if the defender can kind of plant and fall to the ground, there seems to be a lot of barraging call this year. So certainly it needs to be looked at, because I think the game is progressing so much that if you keep the rules at a very kind of a stagnant, this like non-contact level, then it's going to become a whistle-happy game, and it's going to become less easier to market and not as nice to watch or play.
Yeah, absolutely. Louise, great chatting to you as ever. Enjoy the game tomorrow.
Will do, hopefully.
Cheers. Louise Galvin.
Thanks, guys.
There on the line. Kerry footballer and former Ireland international with rugby as well. Right, at 13 minutes past 8 on this Friday morning, we've got a packed show still to come on OTBAM. We'll have our GAA quick picks before 8:30 and we'll catch up with Alan Quinlan. We're hearing from Sam Lee on Ronaldo to Manchester City as well in the next little while, so Quinny is coming your way after 9 o'clock. We're back after these though with the sports pages.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
You are welcome back. We will have a look at the sports pages this morning at 8:15. So otbsports.com is where we're going to start this morning. And the homepage is to do with Cristiano Ronaldo. The only thing he does is score goals. John Giles on the Ronaldo Manchester City links is the lead story. Ulster add Kearney to their new squad ahead of the new season, while Manchester City and PSG drawn in the same Champions League group. So that should be very, very interesting. It could be Ronaldo versus Messi in that one. It's Mick Kearney, by the way, who's joined the Leinster squad, in case you thought Rob was dual playing it with his club in Louth as well as going back to Leinster rugby. Would Ronaldo actually benefit Paris Saint-Germain or Manchester City? Again, more from John Giles. And they don't pretend to be friends. The Hamilton-Verstappen rivalry heats up. So plenty there on OTB Sports, and you can get it on the OTB Sports app as well. Bringing through some of the back pages then this morning. Ellen Keane, as I mentioned earlier on, really dominating proceedings this morning. Keane Edge is the headline on the Irish Examiner. Ellen ends 13-year wait for Paralympic gold, and what an unbelievable performance it was from her in Tokyo yesterday morning. Also a feature on the inside with Owen Bomber-Liston. Thy kingdom come when Kerry stars were treated like heroes in Tyrone. Mickey Hart, you suspect, not overly happy with how Tyrone used to bow down to Kerry, and fierce motivation for them in the 2000s. The back of the Irish Independent. City poised to swoop for Ronaldo. Pep's players back move to sign Portugal's star with a likely salary of over $250,000 a week. Rovers and out then is the headline there, as hoops count cost of Euro exit. And Ireland door not closed to Darren Randolph, and Clark insists Stephen Kenny. The Irish Times is next up, and Ellen Keane dominating proceedings here as well. Keane's dream comes true as she reaps a golden reward. And Mary Hannigan saying, Denny the proudest dog in Ireland as Ellen brings home the bacon. He certainly got a few new admirers yesterday, Denny the dog in Clontarf, in reaction to Ellen winning gold. The back of the Herald is City ready to make play for Ronaldo. Likely salary of over £250,000 a week as Pep's players back move, and door is still open for Clark and Randolph to return, writes Daniel MacDonald. On the back of, I don't know why I call him Daniel, Dan MacDonald. On the back of the Guardian, return to Manchester, City swoop for unsettled Ronaldo. Portugal forward has less than 1 year remaining on his contract, but Juventus want a fee of up to €30 million. And phenomenal route leads from front to punish India. That is the Guardian. Joe Root as well, photographed in the back of the Times in response to the same Indian scoreline. And City in talks with Ronaldo. Champions switch targets after losing out on Kane, but $500,000 a week salary is major obstacle. So they perhaps, not sure who's in front of who with that story. Is the $500,000 thing going to become a sticking point, or actually is he ready to progress with $250,000 a week? We'll get Sam Lee's information on that very shortly. And Southgate gets anti-vax abuse. Gareth Southgate revealed last night he's become a target for anti-vaccination trolls after fronting a government campaign encouraging the population to get jabbed. The Daily Telegraph this morning. City players want Ronaldo to join them. The talk's ongoing with Juventus. The Irish Daily Mail, meanwhile, leads with Ellen Keane. Ellen's golden smile, and then the main story there. Rise and shine. Kenny's call to salvage World Cup chances. He thinks the opportunity to qualify for Qatar is still alive. Tough to get back in it, he says. We're not denying it. And Cahill rejects tip out of loyalty to Waterford. Big GAA story last night is that Liam Cahill is sticking with Waterford despite the fact that a vacancy has arisen in Tipperary. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out in the long term, but surely from the standpoint of the Waterford players, that is a serious mark of loyalty from your manager, and maybe Tipperary in the long run respect that as well, that this is a man who's true to his word, is true to a group of players who he'd obviously told that he's going to stick around with. Ronnie Blue is the back of the Irish Daily Star. City open talks with Cristiano. Then the Mirror go with the Blue Ronnie. CR71 said it was very, very difficult. Now he's in City talks. And then the Irish Sun goes with facts to the wall. Jabs for the boys is best. Kenny insists. So a tricky enough situation there for Stephen Kenny as he faces the reality that a few of his players aren't vaccinated. Tommy, you might just mention that Liam Cahill story. What was your reaction to that yesterday evening? This is a really good news story for Waterford, obviously. Like, does this give them the sort of boost they need to become the closest challenger to Limerick next season?
100%. I think Owen, it tells you a lot about the group that's there in Waterford and the potential that's there in the county, that Liam Cahill and Mikey Bevans are hanging around. Like, they were very, very, very exciting to watch this year. They were very good. They gave Limerick as good as they got for a lot of that game, or for part of that game as well. But I think maybe the run through the qualifiers just caught up in them a wee bit. They had a couple of tough games in a row. I suppose they didn't, like... Do you reckon that they could give Limerick a go of it next year, given the catalyst hanging around and they'll have much of the same players involved again?
It's very, very hard to see anybody giving Limerick a go next season. Mm. The only one that I can picture in my mind it happening is Limerick, and I'm not sure Limerick are even the second best team in the country. It's only because we've seen it happen.
Sorry, who do you mean? You said Limerick.
Kilkenny.
Kilkenny.
Just because we've seen Kilkenny do it in the past. But that's just the only thing I have in my head. And this is where we start to get into a very similar conversation to the one that we would have been having with Dublin recently, where you just couldn't imagine Kildare or Meath putting it up to Dublin. You just couldn't picture it in your head, and it was so bizarre to see it happen at times this summer. And to a point, you could say the same thing about Mayo and Kerry, that at the end of the day it was always going to be the Dublin lad who was celebrating. You could never really imagine the green and gold, or the green and red, actually be on the bodies of the people who were celebrating at the full-time whistle. Your brain just couldn't go there, and we're feeling the same thing about Limerick at the moment. So one way or another we'll be surprised when it happens, I suspect.
Yeah.
And can you really point to much from the last couple of big games that Waterford and Limerick have played as to the reasons why Waterford can beat them, like beaten comprehensively 2 years ago in the final and then beaten comprehensively, as it turned out, this year as well?
Yeah.
But those opening 15 minutes this year before that first water break, I know it's nothing, it's literally a quarter of a game, but there were elements of that Waterford performance really pressurising them up front, as in their forwards getting stuck into them, Gagan pressing-esque, and you thought that might be the first step to it, but unfortunately there are a million of other steps involved to beating Limerick.
Yeah.
Now, we could do factor in the fact that Waterford had a long summer as well.
100%.
And maybe they can turn that into like a 50-60 minute performance where they do go toe to toe. So I'd be encouraged that Waterford are very much going to be on the upward trajectory next season, especially with this guy at the helm. The problem is, how much of an upward trajectory do you need to be on to close the gap?
Well, I agree. I totally agree. I think that the big thing is with Limerick is that Limerick are still able to set their own standards. Like, they're not going to bleed all Ireland medals the way that Dublin did from their dressing room over the last 18 months. So Limerick are still going to set their own standards, which is a scary proposition. But massive news this week that Brian Lowen is probably going to stay on in Clare. Yeah. That's a positive step for Clare hurling.
Yeah.
Positive step for Waterford. Like, that's a massive thing for Waterford hurling fans. Like, a real boost of confidence that Cahill is staying on. Like, Cork, it remains to be seen, you know, what is the kickback from the All-Ireland final in this season? Are they going to, you know, suffer a bit of a hangover from it, or are they going to get a burst of injection from some of the youth coming through? You know, the players this year are going to take it as a positive experience, they're going to move on, and they're going to progress next year. And then there's questions about Tip. Where are Tip at? So it's going to be a really, really interesting hurling season this year, next year, even if Limerick are a step above everyone else.
Yeah, for sure. Good reaction to the football pod this week, Tommy?
Yeah. Humongous reaction to the Dublin Mayo podcast after the semi-final, and it's picked up where it left off. Loads of people getting in touch already. Paddy and Andy are in good form. Paddy Andrews notably is in much better form this week than he was the previous week. He's you know, laughing and joking again. It's the old Paddy we've got back, and Andy's in great form as well. So it's a Tyrone Kerry special. I won't lie, Owen, like, we've talked Kerry up all this year, we've been speaking about them really early in the season. They were probably the team in the league. They were the team that kind of stood out. We spoke about them looking angrier this year and how impressive their attack was. A lot of this week was trying to figure out where Tyrone at, and taking it on its merits, how can Tyrone get at this Kerry team? So, you know, if you're not already subscribed to the Football Pod of Paddy and Andy, go and do it. On a Tuesday, you'll get it first on the OTB Sports app. On a Wednesday, you'll get it everywhere else. And on YouTube, you can watch it on Thursday. But I don't know why you'd be hanging around for Thursday to watch it. I think if I was you, I'd get it on a Tuesday.
Yeah, for sure. And they got the ball rolling on this red sphere that is hurtling towards Kerry at the weekend. This Tyrone momentum that has certainly built over the last couple of days. I think Paddy and Andy were the first people to kick it off. I should mention at 8:24 this morning, OTBA and brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. And it is to the Football Pod we go, because episode 16 is now available wherever you want it. And as Tommy mentioned, get it first on the OTB Sports app every Tuesday. A Tyrone Kerry special basically this week. And here is Paddy Andrews on how he thinks Tyrone should set up.
If you're Tyrone's ideal scenario is you stifle Kerry's attack and play, you slow Kerry down, you slow the ball coming up the pitch to allow you to get numbers back and crowd out O'Shea and Clifford and these guys. And on the flip side, you're looking, how do you hurt Kerry? And the question marks always, geez, for as long as I can remember, is the Kerry full back line. You've seen that first quarter of the Munster final, Cork Cup, Brian Hurley and his brother were causing all sorts of trouble for Jason Foley and these guys. If you're Tyrone, you're looking at, let's slow Kerry down. Let's get 12, 13 bodies behind the ball. Let's break at speed. Let's test, does Paul Geaney or David Clifford want to sprint, or David Moran want to sprint back to their own goal? I don't think they do. But also you're looking down, can we get McCurry and Matty Donnelly on the ball inside the 21? That's the question marks over the Kerry full backline. That's got to be their game plan. Slow Kerry down in transition and break at speed with your runners, but also, can they get McCurry one-on-one with? I think Thomas Sullivan's going to pick up McCurry and Foley. Jason Foley pick up Matty Donnelly. Those two Tyrone forwards will back themselves to win those battles. I think that's, they'll be brilliant, brilliant battles, but that's what Tyrone have to be banking on. I think that's the way they're going to go about it. I don't think it's going to be an open game, because I think an open game just is going to suit Kerry. That's Kerry's preferred style of play.
You faced Tyrone in 2017 and 2018. An All-Ireland semi-final in 17 that I know when you had you on for a retirement chat in February and off the ball, you picked that out as your favourite Dublin game of all time, I think. Or the best performance, I think you said.
That was one of our best performances, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then in 18, you know, you go up against Dublin or Tyrone in the All-Ireland final. And if I remember correctly, 15, 20 minutes into that game, Tyrone were 5-1 ahead that day. Did they do anything? Did they get anything right in those two games to stifle you, or did they do anything to frustrate Dublin in those two? I know they're two different propositions, Dublin 17 and 18 and Kerry today, but did Tyrone do anything?
Not in 17, they didn't. Like I say, I thought we blitzed them in 17. We hadn't played them in probably 3 or 4 years. They'd been in Division 2 and they'd been kind of building, and we were a bit nervous about that game because they were unknown to us. We hadn't played, like Mayo and Kerry were always playing each other in Division 1 and Championship games. We hadn't played Tyrone for years. So we were kind of nervous, and we just blitzed them that day. They didn't get that one right. But in the 18 final, I think that they moved the ball quickly in that first quarter. Like you say, they beat us in a National League game in Croke Park as well earlier that year, where they kept Donnelly up and Colin McShane, and they were letting the ball in quickly. And that worked for them. But like I said, it was very similar to what we've seen in the hurling yesterday. You could see they were playing at their absolute peak for that first quarter, and they weren't going to keep that up. And we were just finding our way. We'd won 3 in a row at that stage. So we'd no panic at that stage. So 5-1, so what? There's only 15 minutes gone.
Yeah. Well, the halftime score was 2-7-6.
Exactly. So we knew they weren't going to keep it up. But also you're looking at, it's a different style of play now. And the way they'd got to what Mickey Hartwell was probably, that was their only real style of play. You felt that they were never going to get over the line in that regard. They'd get to a point and they were just going to come up short against the top teams. And that's why there was so much kind of excitement and people in Tyrone and Tyrone ex-players and supporters looking for a change. And you can see that they're trying to be more expansive, and you can see it through the National League. But I just feel, for this particular game, the way Kerry are playing, I think a slightly more defensive style probably is the best way to go about this for Tyrone. But it's finding that balance. I agree with Andy. It's not a case of bring 15 lads back and just stay there. Because Kerry, if they have the ball for that long, they'll just eventually wear you down. You need to have an attacking threat at the other end. And that's the balance that does Fergal Ogan go, right, 12 guys go back. Mark Bradley, McCurry and Donnelly, you're staying up. And if the 12 Tyrone defenders, it's up to you guys to deal with that Kerry attack. If you can't deal with 12, you know, McCurry or Matty Donnelly's not going to make much of a difference. Let's take the risk, keep those three guys up the pitch, but bring 12 guys into the 45 and just frustrate the shit out of Kerry. I that's the way I see this game going. That's the approach I see. If there's something different and Tyrone do got man to man, I'd be amazed. I'd be amazed if that was the case. But yeah. I was wrong last week about Dublin and Mayo. So I'm not as confident in my predictions anymore.
Paddy Andrews, like a lot of us, still a little bit scarred from his prediction before Dublin versus Mayo. And speaking of dodgy predictions, it is time for ODBAM's GAA Quick Picks.
Some of these critics, these pundits.
I absolutely adore them, lads. I have unbelievable time for them, but they're a great bunch, but it's not acceptable.
They like to play the hard man when they're on it. It's not very pleasant when you're trying to manage a team. All you're looking for is a bit of civility and a bit of decency, but they just dismiss you like you know, you have nothing to do with the bloody occasion.
Just to state that nobody cares about these results, but let's have a look at them anyway to start off this week on the Quick Picks. We're just doing this for fun. The scoreboard is completely incidental to all of our lives.
Hey.
There I am at the bottom, 39 points, who cares? Will, you're on 43 points. You're only one behind Adrian Barry at this point. He's on 44. Tommy on 45. It is very much a three-horse race. This could go any way, and we've got, what, two fixtures left. So really, it is
all... Owen, it's not over, man. You get two results bang on and you're back in the mix.
Thank you, Tommy. You'd need to... Basically, if we go for the same team today, then... Oh, no, actually, no, sorry. If I get all two... If I get the scoreline bang on, everybody else gets zero. So, yeah, so actually, that's I could. So, thank you, Tommy. I need to get two of these bang on and we can do it. So, let's have a look.
Do you want to change your prediction now that you know you can win?
Well, I don't know what you guys are predicting. As always, I play this game honestly and fairly, unlike some people. This week's quick picks for Tyrone versus Kerry, the All-Ireland football semi-final, look like this. So... I see. So we'll start from the smallest margin to the biggest. Adrian, going for Kerry by 3 points. I'm going for Kerry by 4 points. Tommy's going for Kerry by 5 points. And Will O'Callaghan's gone nuclear. Kerry by 9. Will, I like what you've done here. So my issue with Dublin versus Mayo was going for 10 rather than 9. Should have gone for 9 because 10 seems way more dramatic than 9. 9 would have been like a single figure margin, fair enough. But 10 has like former Republic of Ireland internationals spamming you with abuse in the aftermath of the game. So, Will, I like your thinking here. Why are you going for Kerry by 9?
Well, look, that's the exact reason you go to a shop and something's $9.99 as opposed to a tenner.
Correct.
No, I think I had to try and find a point of difference because the exact argument that you've made a moment ago, which is that two exactly correct results are probably required to try and overhaul Tommy, given that we're all going to go for Kerry this weekend and we'll see what happens then with the All-Ireland final. But I actually think that this might be a Kerry 9-point victory because I think Kerry may well let loose. I mean, the evidence that we have so far is that Kerry were well ahead of this Tyrone team when they met at the end of the National Football League. Both teams have come through a hardened championship between now and then, but as we're all aware, Tyrone's preparations for this game have been far from ideal because of their COVID outbreak and because of the lack of training that they were able to have in the first week when the game was put back. I know Kerry have had to sit around for an extra couple of weeks before playing this fixture, but Kerry have been awesome this summer. You can Yarra all you want, but Kerry have been irresistible. Mm. The team of the championship so far, they have been free scoring. And I think even as Paddy Andrews was saying about Tyrone potentially getting players behind the ball and putting up a wall to try and stop Kerry this weekend, I'm backing Kerry to find the answers and to win comfortably on Saturday afternoon.
I just want to respond to that Yarra thing at the moment, Will. And I just want to explain the state of mind at the moment that people in Kerry, I think, I don't speak for anybody in Kerry, but here's what I'm thinking at the moment. So you're right, this Kerry season has been exceptional. It's got people extremely excited, and how could you not be excited after watching some of the football that they've played this year? Even the one thing that you could logistically throw out and say, Dublin really caused problems, and if they play Dublin again then they're screwed because of the 4 goals they scored in the third. That's out the window now because Dublin are gone, so that kind of adds to the excitement. The thing that is just making people nervous is the 5-week gap. So I don't know, it's almost kind of like asking for a really good present for Christmas and that you're almost certain that Santa will be generous enough to deliver it. Like, you've asked for a PS5 and there is something sitting under the Christmas tree wrapped up that looks like a PS5. It's the same size as a PS5. You give it a shake and it even sounds like a PS5 should sound. But then your head starts to go into overdrive. You're like, God, PlayStation 5s are pretty much the same size as a hot point microwave. Could Santa have screwed me over and given me a microwave instead of a PlayStation 5 for Christmas? He's got form, this fella. He delivered a bag of coal just last year. There is every potential that when I open this present on Christmas Day, it will be disappointment. But there is no question about it. PlayStation 5s are absolutely class. They're amazing. And if we open that present tomorrow and the amazing version of Kerry is there, still preserved after 5 weeks, then I think there is no chance to get beaten. So it is that 5 week gap that people are pointing towards. But then I would make the counterpoint around Tyrone that they've had as disrupted a line of preparation. So I can see why you're coming at this from your angle, Will, but I'm just that little bit more nervous.
I look, nerves are understandable. I see Tommy Rooney in the other corner of the screen has been shaking his head since the first moment that we spoke. So I just wanted to say, got a little bit of a kick here.
I just want to say, Will, that the arrogance, the entitlement is absolutely astounding from Owen Sheehan, speaking on behalf of all Kerry people right there. The Santa Claus PS5 line is the greatest thing you've ever said in the show, because that is exactly how you're hardwired down in Kerry. You expect Sam Maguire every year. It's like you write a note at the start of the year, oh please Santa, can we get Sam, please can we get it back? And if that's the attitude going into this weekend, Kerry are in serious bother. If that,
I'm just speaking for myself. But no, Tommy, we write a polite letter to Santa. We behave well all year because he sees you when you're sleeping and all that. And we put in the hard yards that are required to get a good gift at the end. And we'll move off the PS5.
It does look like Kerry have put in the hard yards. It really does. And I really enjoyed that little bit between yourself and Louise there when you were talking about the fact that Kerry people are upset that they weren't the ones to end Dublin's reign. Because that has been the focus for Kerry since 2019. I'd say since forever. Since Dublin went on the 6-in-a-row run, it was so important for Kerry. I think since Mayo bet them, that was a bit of a sucker punch. Like, whatever about how Tyrone have been affected by the COVID outbreak in the camp and the way the game's been pushed back, it's definitely affected Kerry. Well, I don't agree with you that Kerry have been the team of the championship. They were 100% the team of the league. But I actually think that there's been a couple of questions asked to Kerry in Munster where, you know, let's call a spade, you know, the Munster Senior Football Championship isn't the most competitive championship in the country right now. It's not like Ulster. If there was questions asked to Dublin and Leinster, I certainly think there was a couple of questions asked to Kerry. Clare kept them to a very low score for about 50 minutes. Kerry just didn't have the firepower up front to get the job done. Tipperary's wall was broken by Gavin White, and after that they never really posed a challenge, and Cork obviously had that first quarter against them. I actually think that Kerry might spook themselves going into this All-Ireland semi-final a wee bit, and I think they may have done just that. I think you look brave going for 9 points, Will, but I actually think there's only two ways this game goes. I think it goes down to the absolute wire and Tyrone push them all the way, or we're going to see something similar to the league. And I know it's a bit of a contradiction to say it. We're going to see something similar to the league where Tyrone are absolutely wiped and they just can't put up a challenge because of the impact of COVID on the squad. And it ends up being close to 20 points. Because I think if Kerry get their tails up, they're going to put the foot in the throat. I genuinely believe it, that they're going to go for goals and they will absolutely bury Tyrone to get the chance. I just have a feeling that Tyrone are going to be ready to go here this weekend, and it's going to be a really, really good game, and it's going to be tight.
Will, your response to that?
Yeah, look, I mean, we're going in on blind form to a large extent because we're not sure exactly where the two teams are at because of the last few weeks. I would have been far more bullish even about Kerry's chances if this game had been played on the weekend it was due to be played. And I take Tommy's point. I think psychologically it's a weird space for Kerry to be into, because normally they would have been facing into this game on the Sunday just after the semi-final. And say if Dublin had beaten Mayo, the minds would have been so sharp on the idea of trying to get to an All-Ireland final to have that face-off against Dublin. It would be only natural, once Dublin have been knocked out of the championship, that the path seems open, particularly the way that Kerry have got on in All-Ireland finals against Mayo previously, that there'd be a certain amount of giddiness about this. And they've had to wait this couple of weeks to get ready for it. And look, Tyrone have found answers in this championship throughout the year. You know, we've spoken about the coin toss fixtures that they had against Donegal, against Monaghan in the Ulster final, and Tyrone were able to hold on. But I don't know if Tyrone have that scoring power to stick with Kerry if Kerry do open them up with a couple of goals this weekend. And that would be my biggest worry. Like, Tyrone are scoring kind of mid-tens, 15, 16 points in games that they've played so far. I appreciate that there's Ulster viewers who are watching us right now saying that's the nature of the Ulster Championship, but I don't know if Tyrone would be able to stick with Kerry if Kerry get running with a few scores. And I really think there's a big performance in Kerry this weekend. A Munster Championship, sure, they didn't play brilliantly, they worked their way into it, but they were stunning at the end of the Munster Championship, and the way that they put Cork away was just ridiculous, and that was a kind of a statement performance. And I think we could see a similar type of performance against Tyrone this weekend, albeit Tyrone are a much stronger opposition defensively than Cork were, and they're not going to sink in the same way Cork did in that second half.
Yeah, like I also, like, I mean, just to go back to the Gavin Devlin quotes, because they're really interesting. Like, I mean, there's somebody who's involved in the game very recently saying we want the Tyrone can expose Kerry for what they really are. I guess this is a really interesting thread that's actually been written and said quite a bit about Kerry over the last few years, about the fact that they show some sort of defensive weakness in the Munster Championship, and then this thing is thrown out about them that just wait until Dublin get their hands on them. Just you wait. If that's what Cork did to them, just you wait until what Dublin can do to them. Now, of course, Thurles this year, they scored 4 goals against them. But I would actually go back to 2019 when that sort of stuff was being said about them as well. And I think 2019 is a great example that everybody was saying that the frailties that they showed in the Munster Championship were going to be torn asunder when they got up against the All-Ireland champions. And it just never seems to happen. It just doesn't happen in that regard. That I know why people say this. But I think there's a very different Kerry that we see against big teams to the one that we see against weaker teams in Munster, to put it bluntly. And I think it is based a little bit more around a stronger defence. And I think that maybe Peter Keane went one step too far with it last year. And I actually wonder that if there is a slight retreat from Kerry tomorrow, kind of accepting that exposing of Kerry, that possibility is always out there. But they've always come prepared for these sort of big games. I don't know. I just think that what he's saying is interesting, and I think that he's somebody. I don't think we can write off these comments as some fella who's just harping on from the sidelines in Tyrone. This is somebody who knows what an intercounty setup is like, who has done opposition research on Kerry over the last couple of years, and it's very interesting that tone is out there about Kerry in reality in intercounty setups. Now, of course, there's a new management now and it's different now, but I just think it's worth kind of reiterating that.
Yeah, look, I actually think it's a bit more of a war cry from Gavin Devlin to try and remind the Tyrone boys that, look, this is there for you to take. It's so hard to know, like we're previewing this game, it's so hard to know how Tyrone are going to be impacted. I know that it's difficult to predict and make a prediction around that. But one thing that we do know, even if they haven't been affected by a COVID outbreak, is that Tyrone have struggled to score goals all this year. And Tyrone are going to need to score goals if they're going to get at Kerry. They really are going to have to score goals, and they're going to have to stop goals in the far end. Because the frightening thing, and Sean Powder spoke about it on OTBAM yesterday, and I'll finish up on this. Yeah. That Kerry forward line, when they're playing with their six forwards, it's so difficult to have six intercounty defenders to match them. Hampsey and McNamee are going to have their hands full. Tyrone are going to be filtering bodies back to deal with O'Brien and Gainey. Paddy Clifford needs tagging, as Powder said. I just think Kerry are going to have just enough. I think they're going to be challenged, but they're going to have just enough.
Right, and that is reflected in your prediction. Mel O'Callaghan, the headline pick there at a 9-point win for Kerry. Good luck this weekend, lads.
Cheers. Stick it on the
ground. Best of luck to you. Stick it up there.
Just a couple of comments actually coming in before we let you go. Mark says, Owen, you forgot to mention that Xboxes and other consoles are also available. And Paul says, we all love a PS5 in Tralee for sure, Tommy. Who doesn't wish for Sam? I think it's overdue that Kerry scored a lot more goals. That is this week's Quick Picks.
I absolutely adore them, lads. I have unbelievable time for them, but they're a great bunch, but it's not acceptable.
All right, we're turning our attention to the Cristiano Ronaldo to Manchester City transfer saga that is up and running properly now in just a moment. But first, here is Ireland's Dara O'Shea on potentially going toe-to-toe with Ronaldo next week.
That's got to be a dream come true stuff to be marking or possibly marking someone like Cristiano Ronaldo, but we also have the reality of it being a job to do and a World Cup qualification campaign that the Republic of Ireland really need to start salvaging starting from next Wednesday.
Yeah, definitely. It's another opportunity to get points on the board and go out and play for your country. So it's massive. I think first and foremost, there is a job to be done, and that's Portugal there in our way. And I mean, you can look at their squad and you can name their players, and yeah, it probably will be a dream to play against some of them players or line out beside them. But I mean, that's what you want as a player. You want to test yourself against the best players. And I think as a nation, we want to play against these teams. We want to see where we are. We've got great quality. Maybe results haven't gone our way in previous games in the campaign, but I think it was a work in progress, kind of. There's players coming through. The gaffer was implementing his ideas, and the last camp in Spain really helped us out as a group, got us more together, more united, and I think everyone's really looking forward.
Yeah, West Brom and Republic of Ireland defender Dara O'Shea there talking about the possibility and the probability really of facing Cristiano Ronaldo next week in the qualifier against Portugal. Now at 8:43 on this Friday morning, it is time to keep with Cristiano Ronaldo and talk about his club future. Delighted to welcome Sam Lee of The Athletic back to the show. Good morning to you, Sam.
Morning.
Is Ronaldo going to be a City player at the end of this window?
There's a good chance as it stands. I suppose the difficult obstacle, well, there's two. City don't want to pay a fee and Juve are insistent on one, but Juve obviously want to get rid and City obviously want to buy him, so a compromise there isn't too difficult to imagine. The only other thing is, you know, George Mendes has kind of put this on the table by suggesting it to City at a time when City started to think that Kane was less likely to happen. And I don't think it would be Ronaldo's first choice. You know, I'm sure he was offered to other clubs. And I'm just thinking, hypothetically, if Mendes were to say, shall I offer around other clubs? And maybe, you know, other clubs would be stirred into action. Then maybe they could come and do a deal late on. But certainly as it stands today, you know, Ronaldo does want to join City. City do want to sign Ronaldo. And it's just left to City and Juventus to sort it out, and there's going to be talks today, so it could certainly happen.
What would have been ahead of Manchester City on Ronaldo's list?
You'd imagine, hypothetically, if United were in for him again, it would certainly make it easier for him to go back. I think sporting-wise, I do think City's the better option, obviously.
Yeah,
because they're the better team and they've got the better structure. But the whole history with United and the fact that United, you know, they're no mugs these days. They're in the title race this season, you'd have to say. That would be possible. But obviously that would depend on if United wanted to do it. I don't know. Who doesn't want to play for PSG these days?
Sure.
I think Ronaldo, Real Madrid were offered as well. You know, do you want to get Ronaldo back? And they didn't. And obviously they're not going to go that way. But in terms of clubs that he would have definitely said, yeah, okay, we'll go and do that. There's three straight off the bat. But obviously, City are up there. City are definitely up there because they're, you know, one of the best teams in Europe.
It's actually a really interesting conversation then about City's place in the transfer sagas that we've seen this season. And we will get to Harry Kane in just a moment. But when it comes to Lionel Messi and it comes to Kylian Mbappe, I think you've written about this in the past, in fairness. Why exactly is it that Manchester City perhaps didn't look like they had a real chance in either of those sagas? And I accept I'm talking about Mbappe in the past tense here, as if he's already signed for Real Madrid or something.
Yeah, well, it's just, I'm always wary in these situations because everyone's trying to work out your agenda these days. You can't just write something without somebody thinking they know the reason why you're saying it. And obviously, in this case, there's a lot of, oh, well, you know, it's City putting a brave face on things. And they do that. But with Messi, it just wasn't on the table this year. Last year, obviously, it was. And in 2016, it was. But bit of a long story short, City were trying to sign Kane last summer. And then when Messi became available, he rang City and said, look, I'm leaving Barca, should we make it happen? So City dropped the Kane plans, tried to sign Messi. Obviously, it didn't happen in the end. They were left with neither. And they were annoyed about that. And it was the second time it had happened, like I say, because 2016 was the previous time when Luis Suarez and others convinced him to stay at Barca. So this time they just went, well, we're not getting into that. It must also be said, sorry, that everyone just expected Messi to be staying at Barca. Messi expected it. So all summer it was just, well, Messi's staying anyway, and we're not happy with how it went, so we're not going to do anything. And then when the opportunity came around, it was out. They're still going to get Kane, so they stuck with that because they thought they were going to get Kane. And as for Mbappe, kind of similar, but I think they just know he wants to go Real Madrid.
Yeah.
That's simple as that. They know he wants to go to Real Madrid. But also, they tried to sign him in 2017 when he left Monaco for PSG, and it didn't go through. He rejected City, so they thought, well, he doesn't want to come to us. He wants to go to Real Madrid, so forget it.
We shouldn't overly labour the point of Messi, considering it's a done deal now and it's relatively old news. But just on something you said there is quite interesting. Was there not a chance for Manchester City to sort of mobilise the funds, as it were, or the people involved in this move and figure out if Harry Kane is coming or not? Let's get a decision today or tomorrow, Harry, because Lionel Messi is available. Because from what you're saying there, it sounded like that they still had high hopes of signing Harry Kane when Messi announced that he wasn't going to sign for Barcelona.
Well, like I say, when that opportunity to mobilise the troops arose, because, you know, it became clear that he wasn't going to. Like, there was also this other stance that, you know, City had just said, well, no, you've effectively messed us around twice, so we're not getting into that again. So, I mean, they couldn't have even said to Kane, go give us an answer in 24 hours, because they always knew it would be difficult, and they suspected it would drag on, but obviously they always thought they were going to get him, even if late in the window. They knew it wasn't going to be easy. They knew Kane wouldn't be easy. They didn't want to rush it, but like as soon as Messi was on the table for that brief period, they just thought, "Well, we're not bothered this time." Which is a big stance, considering last year everyone thought 34-year-old Messi, is he the best? It doesn't really make sense for City to do it. But they were ready to push the boat. We're going to do it regardless of all those factors that didn't seem to make sense. And then this year to go, no, forget it. It's quite a big swing. But yeah, they just decided that he wasn't for them.
If Ronaldo signs a 2-year deal, as has been widely reported, does that rule Harry Kane out of a move to Manchester City in the next 2 years?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm not sure if Ronaldo would be the biggest factor there, or if, you know, Kane's age or situation would be. Obviously, a lot of City fans are now hoping that the fact that Kane's not coming means that they'll be firmly in the Haaland race. And, you know, if Haaland can do something there, you know, if he's willing to come and City can do that, then, you know, maybe that complicates it more. I think with Ronaldo, I think part of the reasons why they don't want to pay a fee is because obviously if it's, you know, 25 million or whatever, that'll be amortized over 2 years. So in the accounts, that'll be 12.5 million plus obviously the wages. But if you get rid of that 12.5 million per year, it's kind of easy after a year to say, thanks, Ronaldo, you've been really good, but we're going to get this guy in. And either they move him on, or that he's just around the squad and plays sort of a bit part role at the age of 37. You know, by the end of that season, he'll be 38. So I think that's part of the reason they don't want to pay a fee, just because it kind of covers them a bit in terms of the accounts for next season. Because I think, you know, they're so desperate to get a striker in, this is why they're doing it.
Yeah.
Otherwise they wouldn't have, you know, they wouldn't have hastily arranged anything after not getting their top target. They'd say forget it. But they're desperate to get a striker in, so they want to get Ronaldo. It's the best option. But if another good option comes around, whether that's Kane for, I don't know, 100 million, whether it's Haaland for whatever he's going to cost, I'm sure they would do that. And just, you know, they will deal with the Ronaldo situation as it is.
So it does seem a little bit like this deal for Ronaldo is a bit of a band-aid for Manchester City, a bloody good band-aid and an amazing one, but a band-aid all the same.
Well, yeah, of course. They didn't. You know, they wanted Kane. The whole world knows they wanted Kane. It's no secret. But they want a striker. They want goals. You know, the information I've put in an article this morning on how it fit in is, because a lot, you know, it doesn't make sense to a lot of people. And, you know, it doesn't really make it. It's, you know, a lot of elements don't make sense to me. But the best way of put it is Guardiola isn't entirely sure how he's going to fit in terms of the group dynamic. You know, they do their due diligence on their targets. And normally that's why, you know, if it's Harry Maguire or Jorginho and they don't get them, they just say, well, we're not going to rush into anything. We're fine. But in this case, and last summer when they couldn't get Koulibaly, they couldn't get Koundé, so they went and got Diaz. They were like, we need this person, or we need this kind of target. And because Ronaldo's on the table, it's a late in the day option. And yeah, they're desperate to get a striker in. So it is a bit of a band-aid. But yeah, Guardiola, he's not entirely sure how he's going to fit in, kind of, I don't know, ego-wise, attitude-wise or whatever. But he would rather have Ronaldo, like you say, fantastic band-aid, however you want to call it, than not have a striker at all.
There's going to be a lot of
things to go for things this year. They're going to need somebody in the box to put the chances away. That's why they wanted Kane.
I'm sure you've seen already that there's been a lot of people already sharing the 2010 Clasico altercation between Ronaldo and Pep, and I guess that'll be overplayed quite a bit over the next little while, Sam. To me, it seems that what you've got is the meeting of two minds who are focused on one thing and have always been focused on one thing, and that is being unbelievably competitive in the quest to win. If I was a Manchester City fan, I'd be really excited to see how Pep Guardiola and Cristiano Ronaldo combine as people who think a lot about the game.
Yeah, it'd be phenomenal. I mean, it was interesting enough thinking about how Messi would have fit in. You know, late stage Messi doesn't press quite so much. How would it fit in working with Pep again? But like, at least they're like kind of a similar style. They got the same ideas. Like Ronaldo to come and do that is very interesting. And this is one of the elements where people think it doesn't make sense, but you can't stay at the absolute top of the game for about 18 years if you're not willing to put the work in, if you're not willing to do what you're asked. And okay, it's difficult to imagine in terms of the pressing that he would adapt fully, because he's never really done it. But he's never really been asked to do it. I know coaches have made allowances for him, so maybe he has been asked and they've just gone, no, forget it. But that is non-negotiable in a City team. And as much as they want goals, he's going to have to do some kind of work. Although he doesn't do it that often, but from what I've seen, and I was looking over clips, you know, when he does press, he does do it with fantastic energy. You know, he will just sprint at a defender or a goalkeeper. And I wonder if Pep changes things around a bit, the shape a little. And if he gets him to do the same kind of thing that Aguero did, because Aguero never got to like the Gabriel Jesus levels of like ultra intense, intelligent pressing. But Aguero learned enough to carry on playing in that team and scoring goals. And you think with Ronaldo and that adaptability and that, you know, will to win and stay at the top that you mentioned and all those things, even though he's 36 years old and even though, you know, he doesn't look like the greatest team player and he's never really done it in his career, I wouldn't be surprised if he improved certainly enough to get into and stay into this City team, and that would then give him the platform to go and tap in all the chances that I'm sure they'll create.
How does the City team then look with him in it this season?
It'll just be number nine. It's interesting because with Kane, they wanted Kane because he could be a classic number nine, stay in the box, but he could also be a false nine and drop off and bring others into play. And Ronaldo can do a bit of that. It's interesting, actually, because I think the general assumption is he's just a penalty box striker now, and he has been. You know, that was the evolution in his game from about 5 or 6 years ago. But last season, he was doing a bit more outside the box and a bit less in it. So that suggests that he could do either role that Pep wants. But I think if you look now at what Pep's been saying, for example, after the Norwich game at the weekend, when he played Ferran Torres, who's traditionally been a right winger, as a centre forward, and he played Gabriel Jesus, who's traditionally been a striker, as the right winger, he was saying we need the movement inside the box and the determination to stay inside the box and make the movement towards the goal. And he said, whereas Jesus drops off and links up with other players, we need somebody to make those movements in the box. So if that's what Pep wants from his number nine and he's using Ferran Torres there for that, then that's what he's going to want from Ronaldo. Stay in the box, make those runs, win headers. You know, when's the last time you saw a City striker really win headers in the box? And probably going back to Edin Dzeko days, really. Wilfred Bonny, possibly. But just win those headers that City sometimes resort to putting into the box when they can't get going. You know, those difficult days when they can't break a team down, so they put the ball in the box. Get Ronaldo on the end of them. So that's what his role is going to be. It's just going to be as a pure number nine. Maybe he can drop off at times. You know, he will be expected to, you know, back to goal, maybe on the halfway line, bring others in and sprint towards the goal and try and get it on the end of it again. But mainly just penalty box predator.
Does it affect who plays either side of him and even who plays in midfield, having Ronaldo as your number nine?
I don't think so, because, well, I mean, it might do, but not in the sense it would be a problem, because, you know, Guardiola's got thoughts for everything. And if you're playing a certain type of play, you know, he thinks and picks his teams with such depth of knowledge that we could never comprehend. But, you know, he would have been doing that for years anyway. But if there is some element of that, then, he'll come up with those solutions. He's certainly got enough attacking midfielders and wingers to slot around him. Whether, you know, he would require a winger who plays, you know, a right-footed winger on the right, so he doesn't cut in or not, that's something to be worked out. But again, at the weekend, if Ferran Torres was the number nine example, the man who stays in the box, doesn't get too involved in the game, and he doesn't get too involved in the game, Torres. The example there was you had Jesus on the right-hand side and Grealish on the left. So Jesus was staying wide and Grealish was cutting in. I think you could replicate that. You could have Foden on the left staying wide. You could have Mahrez cutting in from the right. I think these are options that, as you said earlier, you know, Guardiola is a top-level coach and Ronaldo's a top-level player, and they've got a lot of top-level players. So I don't think, even if they did have to change things around too much, it would be a problem. But I think it's just great options.
Yeah, it certainly is. It's an unbelievably exciting moment. So just what happens then to the likes of Raheem Sterling and Bernardo Silva this window? Maybe this window's a bit too soon. Maybe it's next summer if Ronaldo comes in.
Yeah, well, the Sterling one's an interesting one, because I think he'd always be open this summer to a new challenge, but who's got the money? Who's got the pulling power? I mean, he hasn't even got the agent. You know, as we've seen with this Mendes one, you know, Mendes, the one who's gone to City and said, what about this? You need that to make these kind of deals happen. You need to lead somebody to just take those calls. Just having a lawyer take care of it, it's just not the same. Kind of as we've seen with Kane, really. You know, everyone around the deal kind of acknowledges that if Kane had proper experienced agents, he'd probably be at City. But he's had family. Sterling hasn't got family, but he's got a lawyer. It's not the same. So I'm not expecting Sterling to go anywhere, and I don't think anybody has been for a while. I know he's been mentioned last 24 hours, but while he would be up for it, I think, which is a big enough statement in itself, I don't think anyone's coming forward. For Bernardo Silva, he obviously does want to go. He wanted to go last summer. City are keen for him to go as well. The thing is, if Ronaldo were to come, obviously being his countryman, good friends, I think, would he be... It's difficult because he obviously wants to go anyway for various reasons, you know, new challenge, you know, kind of, you know, fed up with the dynamic, gone a bit stale, wants to go. And also now Grealish is there as well. So he's got an extra person in his position anyway. Would that be overridden by Ronaldo coming? That's an interesting one. I don't know the answer to that. But he was the one that City were working hardest on. So when Mendes was in Manchester last week, trying to get Ronaldo on the table, and it didn't work at first because Kane was still an option. But, you know, he was trying everything to try and get Bernardo a move because Bernardo's desperate for a move. And City are very happy to let him go, just to, you know, grant him his wish and free up the space in the squad. And obviously at that point, it was if they could get 50 million, then it would help towards Kane. So it's an interesting one now. It's late in the window. I'm wondering if Saul leaves Atletico Madrid for Chelsea, then that opens up a spot at Atletico Madrid. But then would that have to be a loan with an obligation to buy? It's, you know, it's just the situation in the window this year. It's very difficult to envisage these things happening. Like Laporte could have gone, but probably won't. No, Gabriel Jesus could have gone earlier, probably won't. And he's more likely to stay now anyway, because I think he's happy with this wide role. And there's another one, Mahrez. If they'd have had an offer for Mahrez, because he's got 2 years left on his contract, he could have gone if he wanted to. So it's one of these where players have been available, but it's very difficult to move around this summer.
For sure. One last thing I just want to ask you about, Sam, because I remember you writing a piece for The Athletic a few years ago about the signing of Rodri and how it was basically foreshadowed for years that the intricacy with which the Manchester City transfer department pre-planned their moves is incredible. So it's kind of a two-pronged question. First of all, the band-aid nature of this signing, does that go against it? But second of all, does it speak to maybe the fact that Pep Guardiola has stated this week that the avenue for him to leave the club is probably going to become more apparent over these next couple of years?
Well, I think with the Rodri one, that was an example of the first part of that question. They didn't get Jorginho the year before.
True.
But that was during the World Cup. So obviously there would have been a lot of time left during the transfer window, but they didn't panic. You know, they didn't do that. Oh, okay, well, we need to have somebody. We'll go and get this guy. They thought, no, we're fine how we are. And they won the league, to be fair. They thought, we're fine how we are. We'll use the solutions in the squad. And they tried Gundogan. They tried John Stones midway through that season when Fernandinho wasn't there. But they were very calm there. And they waited and they went, right, Rodri's the guy. He does this, this and this. We'll get him in. If they'd been a bit more decisive, they could have got him before he went to Atletico Madrid, because he went for like 20 million euros and ended up paying 60 a year later. But no, that does highlight how they won't normally panic if they don't get their top targets. But like I was saying, there are certain circumstances where they think, we need something. So they didn't get Harry Maguire the summer after that. So same as Jorginho, they didn't panic. They went, we're okay with what we got. It's not ideal, but we'll wait and get the right man. They wanted that to be Koulibaly last summer, and it didn't happen. And then they went to Jules Koundé at Sevilla, because they thought, well, we need somebody. You know, we didn't get anyone last year. We really need somebody. And Koundé didn't happen. So they went, okay, Diaz. And the thing, Benfica's financial situation changed. So Diaz became more possible. So that shows that sometimes if they realise they really do need somebody and they don't get their top target, then they will act and they will go and get somebody else. And now this is what we're seeing with Kane. They wanted Kane last summer. They shelved it themselves for Messi. Didn't get him. They thought they were going to get him this summer. They've realised they couldn't. So they've gone, we really do need something here. This is one of those emergency situations where we need something. And it might not be perfect. It's probably not as good a fit as Diaz was, actually. Yeah. But there's enough there with Ronaldo. Fee, the fact he scores loads of goals, the fact that he's, I don't know, a winner, happy to make the move. You know, there's enough there for City to go, yeah, this is a good deal, because they desperately realise they want and need a striker. And maybe, like you say, it would help ensure that the last years of Guardiola's time at City go well. Because if they don't win the league this year, all of a sudden people are saying, oh, it's three titles in 6 years. With this squad, is it good enough? And then he goes into what would be the last year of his contract, and people saying, he needs to do this, he needs to do that. You remember what it was like at the start of last season when City weren't going well and he hadn't signed the contract? There was a lot of, is this guy the right man? You know, is he still up for it? He looks grumpy, he doesn't look happy, he looks ready to leave. If you were to go into next season with them not having won anything this year, it's just not an ideal situation to be in. So they want to give themselves as good an opportunity to keep the success rolling. And they believe that the best way to do that is a striker. And they've ended up with Ronaldo they might end up with Ronaldo if they can get over the line, because Kane didn't happen.
Sam, always interesting chatting to you. Thanks a million for that this morning.
Thanks very much, guys. Cheers.
Cheers. Sam Lee there, the Manchester City insider for The Athletic. It is 3 minutes past nine this morning, and OTB Sports, in association with Cadbury FC and their club partnerships, are returning for another series of in-depth chats with some of the biggest names in Premier League and Irish football history. With access to all areas, we chat to some of the legendary names from the big clubs and meet the crucial people behind the scenes who make a Premier League club what it is. First up, Champions League and Premier League winners Roberto Di Matteo and Karen Carney will join us for our Access All Areas Chelsea special, along with coach Lisa Fallon. That is coming to OTB Sports social channels very soon indeed. Now, here's what's coming up on OTB Sports Radio today then. From 1:30, we'll have the Paddy Power half hour looking ahead to the weekend's Premier League. From 3:00, Friday Night Racing is live. And then from 4:00, we've got a Team 33 Legends interview with Liam Coyle. From 6:00 then, OTB Gold sees Keith Andrews in conversation with Philly McMahon. And then 7:00, Off the Ball is live on your radio and on the OTB Sports app. Right, Alan Quinlan is joining us shortly, but up next this morning on OTB AM, Phil Egan is bringing us the latest from the Paralympics.
The Paralympics Report on OTB Sports.
With Toyota Ireland. Start your impossible.
Yeah, the Paralympics in full flow, and what a couple of days it's been. We've got our Paralympics report this morning and every morning at 9:00 on OTB AM, and it's all with thanks to Toyota Ireland, and the hashtag is Start Your Impossible. Phil Egan, how are you?
Very well, Owen. Yeah, after the high of Ellen Keane winning gold yesterday, what a moment that was. Another busy day for Team Ireland at the Paralympics in Tokyo, and very close to adding to that gold medal won by Ellen Keane. Paracyclist Ronan Grimes almost got a bronze medal. So he finished fourth in the C4 4,000 metres individual pursuit by setting a personal best. That meant that the Galwegian then went into the bronze medal race. He was up against Diego Dunez of Colombia. Once again, Grimes set his fastest time. He was almost 2 seconds ahead in the race going into the final kilometre. Still led with around 250 metres to go, but Dunez finished strongly, closed the gap, and took the bronze medal ahead of Grimes by 1.394 seconds. And it was Dunez, the last kilometre of that was his fastest part of the race. So just missed out in that one, Ronan Grimes. Now, Rochelle Timothy ended up in 10th place in the C1 to C3 500 metres time trial. The Roscommon native finished her track events with two PBs, still has more action to look forward to. She'll compete in the time trial on the road as well as the road race itself. Roisin Nareen's had quite the week. She's into a third final, so three finals in 3 days. The 16-year-old swimmer from Limerick is into the final of the S13 400 metres freestyle. She'll be back in the pool just after 11:30 this morning. In archery, Kerry Leonard shot a season best of 657 to finish 18th in the ranking round of the Women's Individual Compound Open. That event also decides the seeding for the head-to-head rounds, and Kerry Leonard will be back in action in those head-to-head rounds in the early hours of Sunday morning. Colin Judge lost 3-1 in his last 16 match in the table tennis. More action as we speak. Equestrian rider Michael Murphy competing in the Grade 1 individual test. Kate Kerr Horan is in action later in the Grade 3 individual test. And this afternoon, Greta Streamakita runs in the heats of the T13 1500 metres. Those start just after 2:00. A reminder, you're listening to the Paralympic Report on OTB AM, coming your way every morning at 9:00. And it's all with thanks to Toyota Ireland. Hashtag Start Your Impossible.
The Paralympics Report on OTB Sports.
With Toyota Ireland. Start your impossible.
OTB AM.
With Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
You're welcome back. Now, huge news in the world of golf this week. No, Nathan Murphy has not been drafted in by Padraig Harrington for the Ryder Cup. Leona Maguire has been drafted in to the Solheim Cup, the first Irish player to ever be selected for the tournament. The guys over on Golf Weekly reacted to this news on the pod.
Leona Maguire making the Solheim Cup, Peter. No-brainer decision.
No-brainer decision, no. Well deserves it. This girl's a very, very good player. I was talking to Dermot, her caddy, there the other day. He's really impressed by her. Strikes the ball really, really well. Short game, holds a good few putts. I think, you know, Leona could be a dominant force, and in the ladies game, she just needs a tiny bit more length off the tee. But I think right. That will come. I think that will come, and when it does. But it's great for Irish golf. I have to admit, the ladies have always kind of struggled to have this, you know, shining light, especially Irish ladies. And it's great for the girls who now have a figurehead that they don't have to see for the men's tour. They have a Leona Maguire is there, you know, to look up to and see what she's doing. And we're going to see far more Irish golfers coming forth now. Once one has broken the glass, the others will just follow.
I know. I was just thinking, how much better the Solheim Cup is going to be having like this Irish interest in every session, hopefully. Yeah. You know, like it makes the Solheim Cup so much more appetizing, and it was pretty good anyway.
Yeah, that was this week's Golf Weekly. If you want to listen to their Solheim Cup and Ryder Cup coverage over the next few weeks, head over to otbsports.com/golfweekly and sign up to their Patreon, where you'll also find loads of bonus content, interviews and much, much more. otbsports.com/golfweekly is where you need to go to sign up at just $3.99 a month plus that. Right, it is 12 minutes past nine on this Friday morning. Delighted to welcome Alan Quinlan back from his holidays and back to the show. Good morning to you, Alan. How are you keeping?
Morning, Owen. How are you?
Yeah,
good, thanks.
Good stuff. Nice tan from the holiday.
Well, I'm just after cleaning out 26 hens here in my mother's house in Tipperary, so you're probably in a better seat, a more preferred seat than my last half an hour. I'm a little bit late on, but we have a little business going here selling eggs, so it has to be done, cleaning out the hens this morning.
And how is business going?
Going very well. The hen jar, as we call it, is filling up. Lots of the neighbours calling to my mum's here, and I bring some eggs back to Dublin. So business is good, thankfully.
We must get stuck into the smaller business of the rugby championship and what we've learned over the last couple of weeks, Quinny. This is kind of like an interesting time where we can actually look at what's happening in the Southern Hemisphere. I think it's like the real rugby that's on television at the moment, and we start to kind of, I guess, think to ourselves, how can Ireland play like teams, or how can Northern Hemisphere follow the Southern Hemisphere rugby? Just first off, in terms of pure entertainment, how much more have you enjoyed watching the rugby championship over the last little while? I know disruption to the Australia-New Zealand fixture has been a big factor, but how much have you enjoyed it compared to the Lions tour that we had this year?
A mixture, I think. So much has been said about that Lions tour, and every time I meet someone on the street now or chat to somebody, they're all saying they're disappointed what they saw. And I suppose the criticism hasn't been taken too kindly. I think I see a lot of stuff with South Africans, journalists and stuff online saying, well, they don't care about what style they play, they're winning. And in fairness, they have a winning formula, and they did it at the World Cup, and they did it in the Lions series against all odds, this Lions series, really. But you can't hide away from the fact, Owen, that everybody is saying that it was really disappointing to watch. And you contrast that with the rugby championship, particularly those two Bledisloe Cup games. The first one, 33-25. It's just the ambition to attack. And look, we go on about this a lot over the years. Northern Hemisphere versus Southern Hemisphere, dry pitches. The skill set of New Zealand players as opposed to Northern Hemisphere, and sometimes we're in awe of that, and sometimes there's an obvious difference. It's X-factor players who can just do absolutely brilliant things, particularly the Pacific Island players that play for New Zealand, Fijian, Samoans, Tongans. Their natural flair and ability just to attack from everywhere. And I was really interesting listening to James Lowe. He did an interview this week, and it was covered in all the papers that, you know, that is the mentality, and we know that. We've heard it over the years. I've experienced it myself, and it's all out attack. It's first option is attack. And I suppose, you know, the Northern Hemisphere, the weather dictates a lot of it. But, you know, the last number of years, rugby as a spectacle at times has been challenging to watch. I understand from a player's point of view, from a coach's point of view, it's all about results. It's a results-based. It's driven by results. And, you know, you want to make as... I just think if you were to sum up rugby at the moment, it's about making as little mistakes as possible, playing in the opposition half, forcing pressure on the opposition, defensively being unbelievably hard to break down, and then attack probably comes in at the end bit, you know. So it's the flip side of that in the Southern Hemisphere. And, you know, going back to the original point I was making, no matter what any of the South African or Lions players or management say or World Rugby says, it was dreadful stuff to watch. Mm. And that is a concern going forward. We're going into a new season. You can't just throw the ball around willy-nilly, but it's just that ambition and that ability to have a bit of variety in your attack. And I think Ireland under Andy Farrell realise now that they probably have to change a little bit. And we saw glimpses of that towards the end of the Six Nations. And in the two summer tests, obviously there's less pressure in those summer tests against Japan and USA. But those two games, New Zealand hammered Australia 57-22 in the second Bledisloe game. And it was incredible stuff from New Zealand. And just the intensity and the intent to keep going, keeping the ball alive, trying to put pace on it, was phenomenal. But, you know, you've got to get a mixture of that. New Zealand will come up here in the autumn, and if they go all-out attack against Ireland or in their autumn tests, you know, they could make mistakes, and it'll be a different kind of pressure they deal with.
But making those mistakes, Alan, is probably something that the All Blacks aren't too afraid of at the moment if they're racking up points in the 50s.
No, they're not. And that was always their mentality, is to try and you know, go at teams and attack teams. But they can dog it out as well, you know, and they can be quite cynical. They have that aura about them, and they try to use that to intimidate teams. And they're very, very physically imposing. You know, they're aggressive. They're confrontational, and that's part of their template, that they don't expect this to happen. In fairness, they do earn the right a lot of the time to go wide. They're very, very aggressive in their carries and their breakdown work. So you have to get the fundamentals of your game right. Scrum, line-out and breakdown, they're the three big key areas that allow you attack. But, you know, I went back to this and I think this second test after first attack for the Lions in the South African, close to the South African 22, and they play a couple of phases off the line out, and then Dan Bigger drops 20 yards deep to put up an up and under. You know, Billy LaRue knocked it on, and from the ensuing scrum they get a penalty and they kick 3 points. But we're going to have a problem with people watching the game and enjoying the games if that's the case. There's times in cup rugby where you just got to grind out a result, and that's fine. But the amount of kicking we're seeing in the games nowadays is something that needs to be looked at by World Rugby. The offside line, and I've said this for a number of years, is a real problem. And when I mean the offside line, I mean teams are so good now and at, you know, pushing right up on that offside line and even over it as a group, that the assistant referees are not calling it. It's difficult for the referee to see it, and it's just play on. So if you've 8-10 guys in that front line who are charging off the line, there's going to be a lot of collision-based stuff, and the attacking team don't have the ball in their hand for very long to be able to put some evasive footwork on or look to pass the ball. They're just tucking under the arm and running back at the opposition, and there's a big collision, another breakdown. So I think pulling back the defensive line is something I've called for a number of years. Even a half a metre behind that hindmost foot that is the defensive line. Now, tricky enough to police it, but we need more support from the assistant referees. And the reason I say that it'll encourage attack is because if the out half or the loose forward gets the ball and he has a little bit more time and space, he can run a little bit more evasively and look to try and, you know, give a pass or take on someone with some footwork. Whereas a lot of the time we're just seeing teams crash it up and then the ruck slows down and it's kick the ball into the ruck and it's a box kick. It's horrendous stuff to watch.
Yeah, it really is. And it'll be really, really interesting to see how things develop on the rules front over the next little while. Can I just ask then, considering you've obviously watched a good bit of the All Blacks over the last little while, I'm just really interested in how they've developed tactically since 2019. I presume 2019 goes down as another disaster in the history of the All Blacks, but have they stuck with that? Are they still playing with two playmakers, and have they gone even more attacking than they were in 2019?
They're more attacking, I think, because McKenzie has been full back and amazingly well. You know, when the big games come in, Bowden Barrett will be in the team, whether it be a full back or fly half. But Richie Mwanga is just an incredible attacker. He scores tries, he makes line breaks, he's incredibly fast. And to have his attacking threat, you know, he's not a renowned kicking out of hand fly half, even though his kicking game is quite good. And I would have chatted to Rog about him over the years with when he was with the Crusaders, and that's part of his game that's really, really improved. He's goal kicking, he's kicking out of hand, but it seems to be a tactic from Foster that he wants to keep that attacking threat. And I know Bowden Barrett is an incredible attacker as well, but I think having two of those guys in your back line, it's been floated a little bit in the last couple of years, but obviously Joey Carberry has been injured about having the Carberry, Sexton, the two of them in the back line and adding more potency to attack and having a playmaker, even as a 12. Look, does how long more will Johnny Sexton play? Who knows? I think
is there a
he's still
a
very
talk?
Important player.
Is there legitimacy
yeah,
in that
I think
talk
there
still?
Is. Yeah, well, I think for Joey Carberry, everyone in Irish rugby would love to see Joey Carberry playing regularly, back playing regularly for Munster and being a real option for Ireland. You know, you can play him in a number of positions, 10, 13, 12, fullback. And having that ability to do that, I think, is something that would be a big benefit to Andy Farrell. But New Zealand's attack, it's always been a part of their mentality. I mentioned the X factor. You know, Rico Ioane is a game breaker. Pace, power, Stevu Rees, these guys are individual phenomenons, if you like. But obviously, you've got to... You know, the inside man then, Aaron Smith, the presentation of the ball, the speed of ruck is something that's just incredible. The ball is just whipped away and it gives you that extra second or two. So for Ireland, I think it's all about trying to get more tempo and pace in their game. And of you know, the kicking game is still very much an important part of the game because everybody's really good at the breakdown now. So you don't want to be messing around your own 22, but it's having that ability to add more strings to your attack is really important for Ireland this season, and I think we may see some changes around that. You know, Gavin Coombs, Doris in the back row. I thought Caelan Blades was brilliant for Connacht this year. He just adds an incredible threat. Gibson Park played well. You know, there's going to be pressure on Conor Murray, and I think, you know, it's something that Ireland need to add to and build on, because we saw some positive signs towards the end of the Six Nations, particularly in that English game as well. I think they kind of caught England on the hop a little bit with some of their you know, their attack and their ability to keep the ball for long phases and put footwork in the wider channels. So hopefully that will happen.
Yeah, like it's really, so I don't know, maybe this is kind of like focusing too much on the All Blacks a little bit, but it's quite interesting to see where they are in this state of the World Cup cycle and then holding up a mirror to Ireland in that context. Okay, granted, South Africa won the last World Cup playing a very different style, so it kind of flies in the face of this argument. But is there a case to be made that, like, Andy Farrell is watching these games, seeing how the Rugby Championship is playing out and saying, right, these are the sort of teams we need to be beating if we are going to finally get past the quarterfinal, for example, at the World Cup, and mirroring your style a little bit to suit it? Like, or is that just getting carried away a little bit by what other people are doing?
Yeah, I don't think there's very few teams, if any, can do what New Zealand do, because it does come down to the quality they can select from, the footballers, the natural footballers that they can pick right throughout the team. So throughout their forwards, guys are really comfortable on the ball, offloading, passing, being a scrum half sometimes. I know it's always something that they've really, really pushed, that the props can give a scrum half pass after breakdown if needed. So look, I think Ireland just got to focus on themselves. I think there's some good young players coming through. Someone like Robert Ballancoon, that absolute out-and-out pace, you can't buy that. And I think that's something that would really benefit this Irish side, to get in an X-factor player like that. I still think he needs to improve a little bit, obviously. But there is reasons to be optimistic. And you don't mirror your game on New Zealand because it's, as I said, you can look at some of their attack for sure and the variety they put in attack, but sometimes it's down to personnel and you've got to cut your cloth according to your measure. Yeah. And Northern Hemisphere rugby is different. There's no point in trying to be overly expansive and it's lash and rain in November against the All Blacks. You've got to get, you know, the basics right. But, you know, you go back to the try that they scored against New Zealand a couple of years ago, the chip kick from Stockdale. You know, that's variety. And I think I'd love to see some more of those kind of power plays or attack variation. You know, you saw with the Keith Earls try against England, overthrow, pop back inside from Earls catches and scores. You know, a little bit of that. You can't do it every time, but I think it's just continuously striving to have a little bit more variety and trying to figure out how you can break down the opposition rather than how you can squeeze the opposition to get penalty points.
Just on a final point then, just to go back to the dual playmaking thing, I think everybody agrees that maybe Ireland haven't actually figured out how to work it. Now, in fairness, dual playmaker may not be for Ireland whatsoever. As you say, there are a number of reasons why Ireland can't copy the Southern Hemisphere. But it probably is worth a look if Joey Carberry is going to be a central figure in this. Obviously, it's a risky thing to do at the moment, given Hugo Keenan's been amazing. Ireland's midfielders have been brilliant. But, like, in one of these November tests, is it worth trying Carberry in there at 15 or even in midfield and just seeing how it goes?
Yeah, possibly. I think, you know, they play USA in the first game, then Japan. I think, you know, you want to try and get yourself ready for that third game against New Zealand and then Argentina at the end. So it is an option, I think. You know, the Byrne brothers could play it out half, either one of them. I think Ross or... Ross or Harry. And that could be the future. Harry Byrne could be the future. He's big, strong, physical. So just because if Sexton doesn't play for the next couple of years and he does retire at the end of next season, it doesn't mean that dual playmaker role is gone completely. But look, I think just with Carberry's brilliance and his footwork and stuff like that, he needs to obviously become more robust and get a long run without injuries to see his talents, probably physically get up to speed. I think he struggled a little bit since he's come back just with teams targeting him. Physically, but that's understandable when you're out of the game for a long period of time. So, yeah, I think there is options. Of course, there's options there. There's a lot of young players, particularly in that USA game, that played really well. James Hume is someone from Ulster as well. And Craig Casey, of course, I didn't mention him as the scrum half. He'll have something to say about that. So, Hugo Keenan is a brilliant footballer. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see Ireland try and get the ball into his hands more. He runs brilliant lines, and to try and use him in those wider channels a bit more. So, but look, it's easy to talk about that and say, I just think, you know, having that in your locker to be able to open up or have a go from deep when you need to is something that we look at New Zealand and, you know, if they're 10 points down with 10 minutes to go, they can execute those passes under pressure and you just feel that they're going to get themselves back in the game and they're going to score long-distance tries where they need to.
Yeah,
we'd love to be able to say that about Ireland. But look, it's there is a bit of a transitional period between this World Cup. And do we need to win all these games in November? No, we don't. I'd rather us be peaking for the World Cup this time.
Yeah, I think everybody's with you on that, Alan. We've been burnt enough times. Listen, Alan, great stuff. Enjoy selling the eggs all day today.
Cheers. And if you want, you can put in an order there. When you finish up, you can send me a message for an order for some organic eggs.
Where do we go? Is there a Facebook page or a Twitter page we can go on to?
No, you can just send them to me.
Send it to Alan Quinlan. But anybody at home, Alan,
I might be bringing the revenue down on top of me here and I was selling eggs, but Hopefully not. They'll have a bit of sympathy on us.
At Alan Quinlan 1 is where you want to tweet if you want to get your eggs in, if you're anywhere around Tip today. Quinny, enjoy the weekend.
Cheers, thanks.
Great stuff there from Alan Quinlan. As ever, it is 9:31 on this Friday morning, OTB AM, brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Now, we're going to be back here on OTB AM on Monday morning from 7:30, but plenty coming up on OTB Sports today and across the weekend. You can stay tuned for our social channels and the OTB Sports app. Right now, we are hearing from John Giles on Thursday Night Football.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.